Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
Turned on the TV this morning. Had this shit on about living in a violent world. Showed all these foreign places foreigners living on. Started thinking, man. Either they don't know, don't show, I don't care about what's going on in the hood.
More than 10 years ago, Catherine Flowers was doing economic development work in Lowndes County, Alabama. She learned that people were being arrested in Lowndes for not having working septic systems. On one visit, she met a young woman whose toilet waste flushed directly into a pit out by her back steps. There were mosquitoes around the pit, and Catherine got a bunch of bites.
I didn't think anything of it until I broke out in a rash. When I broke out in that rash, I went to my doctor, and she did all the blood tests and everything to test, and everything came back negative. And I asked her, is it possible that I have something that American doctors are not trained to look for, because they don't even acknowledge that there's a raw sewage problem in this country?
That experience started Flowers onto a new career as an environmental activist. She recently won a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant for her work calling attention to the lack of sanitation infrastructure in some parts of rural America, like Lowndes County, where she's from. I should note, the MacArthur Foundation is a financial supporter of NPR.
A lot of the soil holds water. That's just one of the factors. So when it rains, for an example, it takes a while for the water to drain through the soil. And then the other part, the other condition that I think is related more so to climate change than anything now, is that the water tables are getting higher. So the groundwater, you know, with the water tables being higher, in one case that we've been working on in terms of trying to get septic system placed onto a property, we went down 25 inches and struck water. So with the water tables being high, that makes it bad as well. And then we're having lots of rain, you know, with all of these storms. Whenever it rains, people that do have on-site septic systems tend to have a lot of failures. And failures mean that the sewage will come back into the house or come out on top of the ground because there's too much water.
Can you tell me how common is that? I mean, that's the kind of thing I can imagine. There's a hurricane and a town gets hit particularly hard, and yes, you'll see some of that for a week or for a month. It sounds so like what you're describing is a persistent problem. Tell me what you're looking at when you go into the field.
There are various types of problems. One common type of problem are people that are living in, particularly people that are living in mobile homes who straight pipe, which means that when they flush their toilets, it goes straight out on top of the ground. There are others where people have had wastewater, you know, they have had sanitation through a septic tank, and the septic tank has failed. And when those septic systems fail, it pushes the sewage back into the house. People have complained about it coming in. One family told us they came home and their house was full of raw sewage. In other cases, it'll come in through a bathtub or through a sink and end up in the house. So those are things that we've seen. In other cases, we've seen it outside of the homes. And because they've gotten systems that are just not dealing with the current conditions very well and can't be maintained, because that's always the narrative we're getting. Oh, they can't afford to maintain them. Well, let's build something that they can maintain, because the toilets not only, you know, are for getting rid of waste, but that's where a lot of viruses are deposited, and especially now that we know that raw sewage can emit COVID.
It isn't just COVID, though. I would imagine there are multiple diseases, infections, viruses that would afflict and affect people down there. If folks have raw sewage coming back up into their homes, what does that mean for people's health?
Well, let me pivot to COVID for a minute and then expand. But Lowndes County had the highest per capita death rate and the highest per capita infection rate for COVID in Alabama. And this is a county that has less than 13,000 people. And the educated guess is whether or not the fact that they're around raw sewage made them more susceptible to COVID. We haven't answered that question yet. And then the other thing that we do know is that with our work with the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine, we did find hookworm and other tropical parasites, and we did a study in 2017. So the extent to which there are health problems that are impacted by raw sewage, we don't know the full extent yet. But in terms of knowing that it does have an impact and increases the disparities that exist, we know that that does happen.
This is not just Lowndes County, Alabama. There are other parts of the United States.
This is not just a Lowndes County problem. This is a U.S. problem throughout rural communities, throughout the United States of America. And that's one of the things we want to do is document this, because people don't tend to know that this exists. But throughout the United States, there are places that have wastewater problems, wastewater treatment problems, where sewage ends up on the ground. I went to a place called Centerville, Illinois, where I was invited there by local activists that are working to try to change that problem. I saw just as much raw sewage on the ground there as I saw in Lowndes County. But one of the things that COVID should teach us is that we cannot allow this to exist without addressing it. If we do not address it, then we're going to have more disease, and we're going to have diseases that could be worse than COVID.
What does a win look like in your line of work? I imagine opening people's eyes to the fact that this is happening in the United States is in and of itself huge, but how do you measure success? When do you know at the end of the day, like, something has changed for the better? What does that look like?
Well, first of all, the fact that we're talking about it now. When I first started doing this work, I was told that this was not sexy and this was something that the media wouldn't cover. That's one thing. And then the fact that I had the opportunity to testify, I was called to testify before a subcommittee in Congress. I think that was showing some progress. And then they were talking about this issue in other parts of the country. I think that's also showing progress. And the fact that I've been recognized for this work that is not glamorous, not in the least bit, it's not glamorous at all. But what success looks like is that now we're in discussion about developing technologies that can work. If we can treat wastewater and outer space to drinking water quality, why can't we do that here on Earth?
Kathryn Flowers is founding director of the Center for Rural Enterprise and Environmental Justice and the recipient of the MacArthur Genius Grant. Thank you so much for being with us, Ms. Flowers. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on Black Americans from colonial times to the present.
And now we continue with issue number 22 in our election year series, 30 issues in 30 days. In fact, today we conclude a stretch of 8 days in a row on racial justice issues facing the country and the candidates, its maternal mortality and other health disparities. Now, the United States has the highest rate of deaths related to pregnancy and childbirth compared to other developed nations, even though it spends more on health care than any other country. Tragically, of the 700 to 900 maternal deaths each year in America, the CDC Foundation estimates that 60% are preventable. And as with so many issues in this country, a stark racial disparity lays at the heart of the overall numbers. Black women are 3 times more likely to die of pregnancy-related causes than white women. So joining me now to talk about policies to address the causes, solutions, and where the two presidential candidates stand on these issues, and they do have stands, and this is an issue that very rarely gets discussed in the media, which is exactly why we're bringing it on here on non-commercial WNYC, is Jamila Taylor, Director of Healthcare Reform and Senior Fellow at the Century Foundation. Dr. Taylor, thanks so much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me.
And let me start like this. People don't know that in April, you responded to a request for information from the U.S. Senate Committee on Finance regarding America's ongoing maternal health crisis. And in that letter, you wrote, a black woman with an advanced degree is more likely to die of preventable pregnancy-related causes than a white woman who never finished high school. And it makes a powerful point, obviously, to compare by race and education like that. Can you elaborate?
Sure, absolutely. You know, I like to enter into the conversation about the racial disparities that we see in maternal health, you know, really talking about racism first and foremost. I think, you know, for some that engage in conversations around health disparities, it's hard for them to understand why, you know, a Black woman that has health insurance coverage, who, you know, graduated from college, she may even have an advanced degree, be a lawyer or even a medical doctor, is more likely to have, you know, harmful pregnancy-related experiences than a white woman. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, in this country, we have deep roots in racism. You know, we were built upon the foundations of racism. And so what we see is that racism manifests in various forms. It manifests structurally within our institutions, and the healthcare system is not separated from that. And so the reasons why we see Black women with poor maternal health outcomes is because they do experience racism in the healthcare system. They do experience unequal treatment when it comes to healthcare providers. Oftentimes, they are not listened to by their medical providers when they express pain or discomfort. This is even something that we saw with a Black woman, you know, as famous as Serena Williams. She wrote candidly about her own experiences, telling her healthcare providers, you know, that something didn't quite feel right after the birth of her daughter. And because she had an advocate, both within herself, within her husband, and her network of folks, she got the healthcare that she needed. But too often than not, this doesn't happen for, you know, the everyday Black women that are trying to navigate the healthcare system. And so those racial disparities that we're seeing are the result of an unequal healthcare system and structural racism.
So something that happened 2 years ago that didn't make much news, which is why we want to center it in this series, is that in December of 2018, Congress passed and President Trump signed the Preventing Maternal Deaths Act of 2018. Can you break down what was in that act and whether it's made an impact on racial disparities in maternal mortality 2 years later?
Sure. So what the Preventing Maternal Deaths Act does is it allocates grant funds to states in order to support maternal mortality review committees and you know, also known as MMRCs. And what those bodies do is they assess you know, deaths that are the result of pregnancy-related causes within states. And they also come up with recommendations, you know, to healthcare systems, public health entities. They also have a very important hand in coming up with the data that we need, you know, that is used by the CDC and others to get a full picture of the sense of the racial disparities that we're seeing in maternal mortality. And so from what we know, funding has been going to states. More states are, you know, developing these bodies that are critically important in terms of what we need to know, the research behind this issue. But we need more, right? You know, in order to adequately address this issue, we need a multifactorial approach. So we need better data, which is what these review committees do. We need better assessments of the deaths. But then we also need to make sure that women have coverage. We also need to make sure that we're ridding our healthcare system of inequities. And we also need to make sure that Black women and Black families have the resources they need to thrive and be healthy.
Vice President Biden also addresses the issue of maternal mortality and the racial disparity in that directly on his campaign website. And as a solution, the website states, California came up with a strategy that halved the state's maternal death rate, as President Biden will take this strategy nationwide, unquote. So are you familiar with the California strategy, Dr. Taylor? Can you break it down?
I am familiar with the California strategy. And, you know, lots of experts in the maternal health space, you know, certainly look to California as a model. Certainly, you know, we should be celebrating any state's that can, you know, halve their maternal mortality rates considering what the national picture looks like. Although I will say that one of the issues with California is that whereas they did halve their overall maternal mortality rates, they still have vast racial disparities in maternal mortality. You know, so they did put more funding into the maternal mortality review process, having better measures in terms of data around maternal mortality as well as morbidity. You know, and, you know, they have better access to healthcare than a lot of other states. At the same time, we're still seeing those vast disparities. And so from my perspective, I really think that whereas we're supporting models for change in this area, we also cannot, you know, divorce the issue of racism in the healthcare system. And so that means we also need to be thinking about how we can make sure that all healthcare providers and personnel have anti-racism training. That's first and foremost. We can't divorce that from the conversation around coverage and healthcare quality. And so I do think that that is an area for growth for California. And from, to my knowledge, I think that they did end up passing state-based legislation. I think it was last year that focuses on this training on implicit bias. For providers. And so they are moving forward to think through how they can do better to, you know, address the racial health disparities. But that is something that we don't talk about enough when we talk about the California model.
And another thing that people probably did not hear about when it happened is that in May of last year, Senator Kamala Harris, obviously now running for vice president, introduced legislation in the Senate that would tackle the black maternal mortality rate explicitly, and her proposal includes $25 million aimed at fighting racial bias in maternal care by directing grants to medical schools and other training programs intended to improve care for black women. Do you happen to know if that bill has bipartisan support?
To my knowledge, that bill does not have any Republicans on it. At this time, so it does not have bipartisan support, but I'll also follow up with that and say it's a very important piece of legislation. It was the first time that we sort of saw an approach to addressing the issue around maternal mortality and morbidity that really centered, you know, what we need to do to address the bias and discrimination in the healthcare system. I'll also add to that, in addition to supporting you know, better training, you know, within medical schools across the country, there is an explicit focus on HBCUs, which I think is also an important piece to lift up. The fact that, you know, we do want to support, you know, having healthcare providers, physicians that look like us. You know, I'm a black woman, and I can say for my own personal experience that it is important for me to have healthcare providers that look like me, that look like my child. So I also want to lift that up as an important piece of the conversation and something that is important to black women that we hear directly from them, having providers of color. Available.
Because Senator Harris's bill does target training so much, do you think, in addition to diversifying the field, as you were just talking about, that the American medical establishment can train themselves out of racial bias?
Bye, Felicia.
I think that training will help, right? I mean,
stop it.
You know, I think that my perspective on this is that if you are in a position where you're providing health care to people, you know, you have an obligation to provide them with compassionate care that is void of bias, that is void of discrimination, that is rooted and centered in quality. And so I think that all healthcare providers should be doing their work in that way. And so there's no reason why this is not something that we should do and focus on. It's not only essential to how we approach the vast disparities in maternal mortality in this country, but it's also important to how we address the vast disparities in COVID-19, in heart disease, and diabetes across a host of chronic health issues. And so I think it's extremely important that this is something that we focus on, particularly in this moment of racial justice, the reckoning around racial justice in this country.
Before you go, and we just have a minute or so left, I want to come back to the letter that the Senate Finance Committee invited you to write to them as, in effect, a witness in April on these issues. And I saw that you wrote, the overuse of cesarean sections has been a concern in the United States for decades due to the danger they can pose to mothers. And I see the rate of C-sections is 6 times what it was 50 years ago, according to the National Institutes of Health. Today, 1 in 3 babies, according to this, is born via C-section, according to the CDC. So my question for you about that is, do you also see racial disparities with respect to that, and is that something that needs to be addressed?
Yes, absolutely. We know that actually for Black pregnant women, that they're more likely to have C-sections than white women, even for low-risk pregnancies. And so, again, I think this also fits within the conversation around how we see, you know, this unequal treatment in the healthcare system, you know, even in the context of cesarean sections. And look, you know, having a cesarean is a surgical procedure. It's serious. It's more, you know, invasive than having a birth vaginally. And, you know, it could lead to complications both in the delivery process as well as during the postpartum period. So it's absolutely something that needs to be a part of our strategies in order to address, you know, I think maternal mortality and morbidity as a whole in this country, but we're really centering on the racial disparities as well.
Jamila Taylor, Director of Healthcare Reform and Senior Fellow at the Century Foundation. Dr. Taylor, thank you so much for coming on with us in our 30 Issues in 30 Days series.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
This is the city of Chicago.
Today, Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot says the city is in the midst of a second surge of COVID-19. Chicago is seeing its highest number of cases since the spring, and the number of cases is expected to keep climbing. The mayor implored people to wear masks, keep their distance from others, and especially avoid big gatherings as the holidays approach. WBEZ's Kristen Schorsch is here now to bring us the latest. And Kristen, first give us the latest numbers about COVID-19 in Chicago.
Sure. Well, the outbreak is widespread. It's impacting all age groups and all racial groups. And here's some metrics that public health officials follow closely. In the last 2 weeks, cases have more than doubled to an average of around 500 a day. Now, that's the most cases per day in Chicago since late May, and that was the end of the first wave of COVID-19. Hospitalizations are starting to creep up, and so are the number of people testing positive for COVID. Now, we are doing a lot more COVID testing in Chicago, but city leaders stressed today that just because we're testing more, it doesn't account for why there's so much more COVID.
And did the mayor and public health officials say where the outbreak originated, or even why it's getting worse again?
Well, they partly blamed COVID fatigue, you know, people just getting really sick of staying inside, people not wearing masks, not social distancing. And also, I just want to point out, this isn't one big outbreak. It's not people going to bars or going to school or riding public transit, things that people typically fear, like being out in public. This is how it's spreading. It's really people who are hanging out inside each other's homes and going to big gatherings. Here's our Chicago Public Health Commissioner, Dr. Allison Arwoody.
Please do not invite anyone over to your house or apartment. This is not the time for non-essential gatherings, period.
So she was obviously really passionate today. I feel like, you know, more passionate than a lot of these press conferences because they're seeing this big rise. She said, I thought this was an interesting point. If you're in a group of 10 people, there's a 14% chance someone in that group has COVID right now. And that risk goes up the bigger the group.
Okay, so now that the city health officials say, you know, we're in this second surge, what happens next?
You know, it's unclear. The message today was mostly this is not the time for getting too comfortable with COVID, but the mayor didn't lay out any big plans for combating the spread. There's nothing like the type of stay-at-home orders that we had in the spring, which really hurt the economy, but it brought the COVID numbers down. I will say, though, she did not rule out imposing restrictions on businesses again, which obviously then trickles down to the customers.
And Kristen, you really have been leading our reporting on the pandemic since the beginning. As we look for another surge happening here, what questions are you reporting out?
Yeah, well, I've been on the phone and Zoom a lot today, talking with hospitals, and some told me they're already seeing an uptick in cases. Others are waiting to see how the next few weeks unfold. That's because it typically takes a few weeks from the time you see a spike in cases to people getting so sick that they wind up in a hospital. And I just also want to point out that many hospitals are still trying to recover from the first wave we had in the spring. Like, they lost a lot of money. Some had to lay off staff. Others were trying to hire again. So one thing I'm, you know, really closely tracking is how are they going to be ready for this another surge? And a big reason behind the reminder to wear the masks and to social distance is to make sure that hospitals don't get overwhelmed. We're seeing, obviously, you know, stories we're seeing out of Wisconsin of that happening.
WBEZ's Kristen Shores. Kristen, thanks for bringing us that important update.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Next time you get over on a fool and you did the shit like Will Smooth, thank guys too for giving up the facts and ask yourself, who's the man?
Two weeks from today, Americans finish casting votes. We are 14 days from November 3rd, which is Election Day, though with so many people voting earlier by mail, it's really the climax of election season.
Yes, it is, but it is not the end of election season because we don't know how long it's going to take to count all the mail-in ballots. For example, the U.S. Supreme Court just upheld a rule in Pennsylvania. That court ruling means it's okay to count ballots that arrive in the mail after Election Day.
NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson is here to survey the election 2 weeks out. Mara, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Okay, so Pennsylvania, obviously a very important swing state. What does the court ruling mean?
The court let stand a Pennsylvania state Supreme Court ruling that as long as a ballot is received within 3 days of Election Day, it can be counted as long as it's counted by Friday, November 6th. This is a win for Democrats. There are a lot of cases like this in the courts because the rules for counting ballots are in large part set by each individual state.
Hmm. And, of course, Pennsylvania is a vital state. And what this means is if it's really close, we might not know for a couple of days the winner. Although if it's a blowout, we could very well know who wins Pennsylvania on election night. We just don't know.
That's right.
And anyway, that rule is set for now. And then there are new rules for the last presidential debate coming up on Thursday. What are they?
The Commission on Debate says that each candidate will have 2 minutes uninterrupted to speak at the start of each segment of the debate. The candidate who isn't speaking is going to have their microphone muted.
Mara, let me just interrupt to say, actually, I'm just interrupting to demonstrate what happened in the first debate. Please proceed. Go on.
This comes after the last presidential debate in which Donald Trump interrupted repeatedly. It was very chaotic. And then, remember, the next debate was canceled after Donald Trump refused to do it virtually. He said at the time that in a virtual debate, they can cut off your mic whenever they want. The Trump campaign released a statement saying it is still committed to debating on Thursday, although the president has complained about the subjects of the debate, which are chosen by the moderator. And he's also attacked the moderator, NBC correspondent Kristen Welker, for being biased.
Now, everything we've mentioned so far has been touched by the coronavirus. Voting is different. Debates are different than in past years for many reasons, one of them being the pandemic. How are the candidates talking about the pandemic in the final stretch?
Well, it's interesting. The coronavirus cases happen to be spiking. Right now, they're at their highest since the end of July. But President Trump is delivering the same message on the virus as he has for months, even after he himself got COVID. And the message is that the virus is no longer a problem. It's in the rearview mirror. He said yesterday at a rally in Prescott, Arizona, that the only people who still care about the virus are those trying to hurt him and that Americans have just had it with the pandemic. Here he is.
Pandemic. They're getting tired of the pandemic, aren't they? Getting tired of the pandemic. You turn on CNN, that's all they cover. COVID, COVID, pandemic, COVID, COVID, COVID. You know why? They're trying to talk everybody out of voting. People aren't buying at CNN, you dumb bastards. They're not buying it.
I guess we're obliged to note first, there's no evidence of that conspiracy theory about why there'd be lots of pandemic coverage. It has killed well over 200,000 people. Pretty big story. But I want to note also, Mara, the president's opponent is Joe Biden, but here he is attacking CNN and also even his own health experts.
That's right. He is, and according to a New York Times report, he attacked Dr. Fauci, said Dr. Fauci. What, on a campaign call, he said, quote, people are tired of hearing from Fauci and these idiots, all these idiots who got it wrong. At the Arizona rally, he said Fauci was a disaster. He attacked Biden for, quote, listening to Fauci. Biden said later in the statement, that's not an attack. That's a badge of honor.
One other thing. There was an effort to get coronavirus relief before the election. Is there any chance left of that?
Well, it's unclear. Nancy Pelosi says if you can't get a deal by today, you're not going to get one passed before Election Day, and the two sides are still pretty far apart.
Mara, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
So fly like a ninja, but don't follow us wherever we go. The shit that I'm saying, make sure it's heard. Motherfuck you when you punk ass ghetto bird.
For the family of Christine Jessup and the man who was falsely accused of her murder, it offered at least some closure. Toronto police announced last week that they had identified the man they believe is responsible for the 9-year-old girl's disappearance and death in 1984. And they did it using an emerging technique known as forensic or genetic genealogy. This has been around in recent years and used in recent years to identify serial killers, clear missing persons cases, and reunite families. And while it is giving police new hope, it's also raising concerns about privacy. More on that in a moment. First, though, I'm joined by a forensic genealogist who worked with Toronto Police on the Christine Jessup case, Anthony Redgrave. Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Tell me about the role that you and your team played in identifying the man that police now believe killed Christine Jessup.
Yes, I was the lead forensic genealogist for the team that came to a candidate for identification for the Toronto Police. We received the kit number associated with the perpetrator DNA, and from there we did our part to work on the genetic matches of that perpetrator kit, the living cousins who had willingly submitted their DNA. Mm. To and opted into law enforcement matching, so everybody had already agreed to this. For us to use their relationships to each other to determine where this unknown person fit in with that puzzle and where they might fall in relation to everyone.
So walk me through how you do this. Police give you a DNA sample, then what happens?
Well, the police submit the DNA sample to the lab. The lab goes through their process to create a digitized file that is then uploaded to GEDmatch or FamilyTree DNA. The lab was Othram out of Texas, and I was the lead forensic genealogist for the lab at the time. I am no longer working for them, but this is one of the cases that I was contracted with them on. So when the lab receives the DNA sample, they digitize it and form it into a file that can be uploaded to these sites. Once it's uploaded, I have access to that information via a login, and our ability to see the DNA matches of this kit, the people who share genetic material with the unidentified person, we can see them, but they can't see us because it's an open forensic investigation, and we go in through a law enforcement flagged kit that doesn't show up in other people's match lists. So, for example, if you were working with if you had done a DNA test, you would see everyone in the entire database who had also tested at that company. We only get to see the ones who have clicked the little button that says I opt into law enforcement matching,
right,
and we're invisible to them so that they can't see our kit, so that we keep the investigation private.
How close of a relative do you need to find in these public databases in order to identify a subject? I mean, you think of there's that, you know, the cliche is a needle in a haystack, but the haystack is gigantic here. How close of a relative do you need?
Well, it's not just one needle in a haystack. It's several needles. It depends on the case. Sometimes you get lucky and you end up with a first or second cousin who's just sitting there, and then you can figure it out sometimes relatively simply if that relationship to that person is documented and they're not an NPE or not the parent expected, which is when, you know, you don't know exactly who your parents are.
Mm-hmm.
And what usually happens is that we have a whole bunch of people who are third cousins or more distant, and we find clusters of those people who are related to each other, figure out who their common ancestor is with each other, and then we can assume from that point that if we know that two or more people descend from this one couple, this third person who we don't know who they are probably also descends from there. And we have to do that a whole bunch of times over and over again and find the places where descendants of those common ancestor couples also marry each other and make somebody who combines the DNA and is the likely place to look for the person that we're trying to identify.
So this is the same technique in some ways that's used by those ancestry sites to try and figure out what your family tree looks like. You're just using it to match DNA that police have submitted to you to try to figure out who a suspect might be.
Yes, it's very similar to the way that a person who is adopted might search for their birth family, except in our instance, we can't ask the person who the DNA came from, where they were born or what their name is or any unidentifying information, and we're not working on identifying their parents, we're working on identifying them. So it's just kind of the same puzzle but on hard mode, and also we don't contact people and ask them, hey, can you tell me about your family? I'm looking for somebody. Because it's an open investigation, right. We do our best to stay quiet in the background and not reveal any information about what we're working on.
Do you know what you're investigating? I mean, when you were working on this case, did you know the specifics of it, or do you just have the DNA and you're just trying to find the match?
Yes, we did. We knew the specifics of the case. It's very important for us to know the specifics of the case and be in contact with the investigating agency in order to get more contextual information, because you never know what piece of information is going to be useful when you're working on one of these cases, and they might not give it to you right away, and you might have to ask. And again, that's another case in which it's very similar to how you might work on an adoptee case. They might know a story from someone that they don't think of until it comes up, unless you ask them, like, I'm seeing this happening. Is this something that I should be concerned about? So yes, we had the details of the case. We knew where and when it happened, and we knew about the wrongful conviction. We knew about how there were very, very many people who were investigated and cleared through DNA or otherwise. So we knew the long and arduous history of this case.
Your interest in this
from the beginning.
How reliable is this science?
Yeah, well, it's incredibly reliable because in the grand scheme of things, everyone has parents and everyone has the DNA of their parents, and therefore you are very likely to have some genetic cousin somewhere who's already submitted a DNA test. It's not as thoroughly vetted yet as STR testing, which is the standard for forensic DNA. But what we end up doing is we come down to the nearest possible identification we can get. Sometimes it's usually the exact person, if not a group of siblings. And then we'll pass that candidate for identification to law enforcement to follow through with confirming via SDR testing or fingerprints or dental records or interviewing family members. So they consider it a very highly scientific tip that's being passed off. And therefore, for extra assurance that we have the right ID and via means that are standardly used in court as forensic evidence.
I ask in part because there have been cases where the wrong suspect has been identified. Have a listen to Michael Yousry, who's a filmmaker from New Orleans, was questioned by police after forensic genealogy identified him as a suspect in a horrific rape and murder case. He spoke with PBS NewsHour last year.
I kept asking questions like, did somebody I know do something horrible? And finally, after maybe about an hour or two, they had to just basically go, no, we think that you were involved with this crime. And I'm like, me? When it came crashing down was when they walked out of the room and the biggest state policeman that I've ever seen in my life came in with latex gloves and a cotton swab. and said, I'm going to take your DNA now.
That DNA test ended up clearing Mukwege, but that took weeks mm-hmm. for it to happen. Do you worry that there's a lot of excitement around this case in particular because of the answers that have been found decades later? Do you worry that the work could end up winding police down the wrong path and leading them to the wrong person?
Well, I believe that if I personally have the ability to communicate directly with the law enforcement agency and tell them exactly the information that I have and explained it in terms that are very clearly understood, that particular situation would be completely avoidable. In the case of Michael Ussery, he was wrongfully accused due to, honestly, I believe it was a communication error between the people working on his case and the law enforcement agency, because that was done with Y-DNA, and a possible surname was presented, but it may not have been fully understood to the person that was communicated to exactly what that meant. It wasn't a confirmed ID. It was a possible surname. And as we know, it's entirely possible for a patrilineal surname to get broken along the way and not be the right name. In the work that we do, we use autosomal DNA, and we very rarely use Y-DNA in our process.
And that's more specific.
Except for purposes of confirming.
Yeah. Just before I let you go, are there safeguards that you think need to be in place to ensure that this technology, which is growing, is used appropriately?
Absolutely. I personally feel that there is a middle ground in which people who are working on cold case investigations for families who deserve answers and have been waiting a long time can do that and also respect the privacy and personal concerns of people who are living DNA matches or relatives who might be looked at via DNA. There are very clear terms of services on the sites that we use, and they should be adhered to, but there's not a whole lot that goes into really making it clear what that means. I think there needs to be a more public education aspect to what it means to opt into law enforcement matching, and I think there also needs to be more education for departments on how to use it appropriately and fairly. And that's actually something that my doctoral studies are on right now, is actually developing educational materials and policy making and training programs so that the future of this field can be protected in a way that serves everyone fairly.
Brenda McPhail is with the Canadian Civil Liberties Association and has been listening in. Brenda, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Anthony Redgrave uses commercial DNA databases. When you hear about the work that he's doing and those databases, what concerns you most from a privacy perspective?
Well, I mean, there are really nuanced issues at play in cases like this, because, of course, it's a good thing for the Jessup family to finally have closure. The public wants justice in these kinds of cases, and it matters to all of us that they get solved. But there are important things to think about when it comes to using a commercial or a public genetic database for policing, because, DNA is the building block of our bodies, so it's the ultimate intimate and sensitive information. There's a bunch of these kinds of services out there. They range. They're very different in terms of what they allow in terms of police interaction with their databases. Some don't voluntarily cooperate with police or let them upload data, and others do. So it's, in some ways, it's buyer beware, but it's buyer beware in an incredibly complicated environment where the consequences for clicking the opt-in, as your previous guest said, are huge and for many people, really unknowable.
The investigators working on the Jessup case used this ancestry site called GEDmatch, and the disclaimer there says that users have explicitly given permission for their information to be accessed by law enforcement. Is that enough?
Well, the question is whether or not somebody who just wants to go online and find a long-lost cousin ever read or understood that policy or what it might mean for them. So again, there's a fine line between informed consent and meaningless consent. And meaningless consent is contrary to privacy laws here in Canada and many other places around the world. And then we have to ask, what does it mean to give consent to using a genetic database? Because you're not consenting just for yourself. I mean, this is ancestor matching. You're consenting for all those who came before you, your children, their unborn children, and, forward into the future. So how reasonable is it to ask one individual to consent to the exposure of that many others who are connected to them.
Is there any precedent for something like that where you click yes to something, but it has nothing, it has something to do with you, but it could, you know, possibly implicate many, many other people?
Well, I mean, the most recent example is probably the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which is a very different kind of situation, but where, you know, a few hundred thousand people agreed to do a survey for research purposes and ended up implicating all of their friends and the friends of their friends and the friends of those friends, extending to millions and millions of people, profiling, ultimately with the purpose of, you know, influencing elections, potentially. So that's a sort of a contemporary example of the way that these sort of effects can ripple out and expand. And in that case, I mean, there have been investigations here in Canada that basically said that was absolutely not a legitimate way to go about collecting information.
Benjamin Berkman is a deputy director of bioethics at the National Human Genome Research Institute in Maryland. Take a listen to his thoughts on this whole new field of genetic genealogy.
Once people see the power of this technology and the ability to bring these cold cases to justice, years after people, investigators have given up on these cases, I think most people will feel pretty comfortable or even enthusiastic about it. But, you know, some people have a distrust of law enforcement. Some people feel very, very sensitive about how their genetic information is shared and used. Even though I think those people are all going to be in the minority, it's still important to respect their views.
Brenda McPhail, he talks about the enthusiasm that people have around this technology. Again, on Friday when this information, Thursday and Friday when this information came out around the Jessup case, you could imagine that there were a lot of people who would look to law enforcement to say, okay, what else can you do with this? Are you concerned about that enthusiasm?
Very concerned. I think that we've got all kinds of new technologies that are allowing us to do amazing things. It's natural and reasonable and right, in fact, that law enforcement want to use them. But there's a trend towards moving towards bulk surveillance technologies. So this genetic kind of matching essentially searches tens of thousands or more looking for one. We've got other examples of these kinds of relatively indiscriminate technologies being used by police. We've got IMSI catchers, cell site simulators that capture the information from people's phones of everyone in the vicinity, again, looking for the identifier of one. Facial recognition has the potential to scan everybody in a space, rendering everybody identifiable, again, looking for one. Essentially what it is a fundamental change to the social contract in a democracy, where we expect to be free of scrutiny by the state unless there's a reason to believe that we're a danger to society. And with these kind of bulk methods of surveillance, everyone is under a low-grade suspicion all the time. It can be, you know, you ask what the harm is of that. If we can catch a really bad guy, yeah, Isn't it okay that, you know, that rights are a little bit infringed for the greater good?
Because people will say, if you've done nothing wrong, then what do you have to worry about?
Right. If you have nothing to hide, why do you care if you're looked at and then dismissed in a police investigation? And there's two kinds of risks there. One you've already highlighted, it's the risk of misidentification and the anguish that can come from getting it wrong. And let's be clear that different people have different risks of that misidentification going very badly because they don't have the resources to get themselves out of it. There's an example of a guy who rode his bike around his Florida neighborhood using a fitness app on his Android phone. He got a message from Google's legal investigations team telling him his data had been requested in a police investigation. And when he was smart, and he was a young guy, he was smart enough when he told his parents, they said, we're going to dip into our savings. We're going to get you a lawyer. And that was very wise because he was able to get himself out of the suspicion of a particularly violent burglar in his neighborhood that he was suspect of because police got a geofence warrant to see the location data of everyone in the vicinity of that crime. And because he'd been out doing laps on his bike, he was a suspect.
A cautionary...
All he had to hide was the 10 pounds he was trying to shed. But he got caught up in the investigation.
A cautionary tale, Brenda. We'll leave it there. I appreciate you speaking with us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you.
Brenda McPhail, Director of the Privacy, Technology, and Surveillance Project for the Canadian Civil Liberties Association.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.
With a curler is most wanted.
America's Most Wanted reports that Ice Cube is the leader of the lynch mob. Also in the group, they have JD, T-Bone, Chill, Yo-Yo, Dell, Katie. Sounds like a black man.
New at 6, a new measure in San Francisco could result in legal action against people who make non-emergency calls to 911 that are determined to be racially motivated. KPIX 5's Andrea Borba is live with what inspired this new measure. Andrea?
Well, Ken, the joke about the Karens of the world is not just a meme in the eyes of Supervisor Shimon Walton here in San Francisco. He says misuse of the 911 system can be deadly serious for people of color.
They are the viral moments that captured worldwide attention. Barbecue Becky at Lake Merritt in Oakland. The woman who called 911 on a black bird watcher in Central Park. Permit Patty in San Francisco, who called police on children running a lemonade stand. District 10 Supervisor Shimon Walton wants the people who make those calls to be civilly liable in what's being called the Karen Act.
And we want to make sure that people don't continue to weaponize emergency calls to law enforcement.
What's going on? Karen is an acronym for Caution Against Racially Exploitative Non-Emergency Phone Calls. It was authored by Walton, but has the full backing of the Board of Supervisors.
You call the police on me, they come and they assault me or some altercation happens, and then I choose to sue the police department or sue you, you could be liable for at least $1,000.
We asked voters at Civic Center what they think of the measure.
Because they're using their white privilege to, you know, to create trouble for someone else that isn't based on reality.
People with privilege like myself use that to our advantage sometimes. And a lot of that uncertainty that comes with not knowing people of color allows us that space to make those accusations safely. And it's going to take a hard check to get some of that righted. So I actually think it's an interesting and potentially game-changing measure.
Though Jason Powers doesn't think the measure itself will make people think twice about dialing 911.
It's going to take actual accountability. And that doesn't come from a measure being passed. It comes from the after.
Now, the Karen Act passed the Board of Supervisors today with a unanimous vote. It will have a second reading next week before it heads to Mayor London Breed. Live in San Francisco tonight, Andrea Borba, KPIX 5.
The gangsters in the known universe are all classified as white. Gusty Renegade, Context of White Supremacy. The segment that we are about to hear, this aired on NPR just a couple days ago. It is titled, Why More White Voters May Not Support Trump in 2020. This is a lengthier segment. You just have to listen to it. I heard this, and I have been pretty staunch, consistent in my views about who's going to be successful in this election. One of the keys that I remember from 2016 when Dr. Welsing, the grandcestor, accurately forecasted what would take place, there were so many inaccurate reports, especially the final 30 days leading up to the election in 2016. So many inaccurate reports. It's going to be a landslide. It's going to be an embarrassment. Hillary Clinton is just going to trounce him at the polls. This could be the worst defeat ever for a U.S. presidential election. And extra super wrong. When I hear a report like this, it only strengthens my views that it's going to be FOMO years, especially listen to the way that they talk about white women. Remember 2016? 52% of white women voters across all socioeconomic backgrounds, so they call it, supported our current president.
Questions about how white people voted in the last presidential election kicked off barely 24 hours after Election Day 2016, and Democrats bore the brunt of it.
Is there a chronic problem for the Democrats with white working class voters?
The answer seemed to be yes, and at the time there was a lot of media attention paid to the so-called white working class.
Has the relationship between the party and that very, very large block in the population, has it been broken?
Now, I was here on air that day after the election watching my co-host Robert Siegel get into it with Michigan Democrat Debbie Dingell.
I don't know that it's broken, but we as Democrats have to take a very strong look at what happened.
What happened was Donald Trump won Michigan.
Let's take a look at the Electoral College map.
And Wisconsin.
With that win in Wisconsin, look at how close he is. Right now he has 257 electoral votes.
And Pennsylvania.
It's the first time Pennsylvania has gone red since 1988.
This was the so-called blue wall of states where white voters had helped Democrats win for decades.
And the wall comes tumbling down. This is the blue wall that Hillary Clinton had talked about.
Now the blue wall is shored up by white voters without college degrees. And yes, a lot has been said about how Trump won the majority of them. But polls show this year, for a Democratic presidential candidate, Joe Biden is showing record support with white voters, running nearly 50-50 with the president. And that is a problem for Trump's re-election strategy. Overall, in 2016, Donald Trump won white voters by 20 points. But this year, public opinion polls show Joe Biden outperforming Hillary Clinton with white voters in general.
Good afternoon, Winnebago Democrats. How may I help you?
Winnebago County, Wisconsin went for Barack Obama twice, in 2008 and again in 2012, but then flipped to Trump in 2016.
6 months ago, I was scared because I was here during the 2016 election and we were so confident, but we never seen stuff like this. This is unbelievable.
Pam Henkel is a volunteer coordinator for Democrats in Winnebago County. That's southwest of Green Bay. In 2016, the party wasn't even sure it could keep paying rent on its headquarters. Now, with all the donations flowing in, Henkel says they have enough in the bank to pay rent in advance for the whole year.
Now, I've got so many volunteers, I'm not even knowing where to put them. I did have another gentleman this morning come in and say he wouldn't vote Republican again, and he was voting Democrat and took Biden signs.
One thing Henkel says is accelerating the shift, the coronavirus outbreak in Wisconsin.
My plan will crush the virus and will make Wisconsin greater than ever before. That's what's going to happen.
In a visit to Janesville, Wisconsin this past week, the president told a crowd of supporters not to worry.
You know, you have a spike, you have a surge, but if you remember, 2 months ago, Florida had a big surge.
But hospitalizations in Wisconsin have more than tripled in the past month. A couple hours south of Winnebago County, a field hospital just opened up on the grounds of the Wisconsin State Fair.
One guy said he's been voting Republican for over 40 years, but he doesn't think he could go back to being a Republican because of the way they're thinking and the way they're supporting Trump.
Pam Henkel spoke to NPR's Sam Greenglass. He's been talking to white voters in battleground states who aren't voting for Trump this year. Hey there, Sam.
Hey, howdy.
So we've just hit Wisconsin. What's next?
Okay, so let's hop across the lake to suburban Michigan now. Because don't forget, when we talk about white voters, we're not just talking about blue-collar voters. We're talking about wealthier suburban voters, too, like Nancy Stroll.
I voted for Barry Goldwater, so I've been around a long time.
She lives in this exurban part of Oakland County, and it's a place that used to be pretty Republican, think Mitt Romney-type Republican. But it's been getting a lot bluer over the last few years. Stroll had voted Republican for a really long time.
I could not bring myself to vote for Trump. I just couldn't.
In 2018, she actually started volunteering for the Democratic candidate for Congress, who ended up flipping the seat blue. And when Stroll went door knocking that year, it was often women who would step outside, shut the door a little bit, and say they were going to support the Democrat.
I can't speak for my husband, she would say, but she has my vote.
Stroll is 78, and she says it's not just women she's heard from. A lot of seniors don't want to vote for Trump either. They can't hug their grandkids right now because of the pandemic, and a lot of them see Trump as being somewhat responsible for that. Stroll told me she's not just thinking about this one election, but the country her kids and her grandkids are going to inherit.
I'm looking in the rearview mirror of my life, but that's not the case for my son and his wife, and for my nearly 2.5-year-old grandson and my 9-week-old granddaughter.
But Republicans like Stroll couldn't bring themselves to vote for Trump in 2016. What are you hearing from voters who did?
Well, first of all, I've talked to a lot of people who voted for Trump in 2016 and are planning to do it again. But then there's also people like Jim Diaz.
I'm 25 years old, and I'm from Charleroi, Pennsylvania, which is in the Mon Valley.
He works in glass installation. He's a union member, comes from this long line of organized labor and Democrats, and he lives in western Pennsylvania, a part of the state that fell on hard times when a lot of steel jobs disappeared. Diaz liked Obama, still does, absolutely would have voted for him if he was old enough at the time. But when he turned 18, he voted for Trump.
Listening to Donald Trump saying, like, we're going to bring these jobs back to America. I bought into it. Like, I really bought into it. Because I thought, like, man, like, you know, my family has seen some good times in America, and that was all thanks to the steel mill. But when that dried up, well, you got to find other work.
But since then, Diaz's political outlook has really shifted. A lot of it has been from joining the union, growing up, following politics more. But he also says Trump didn't fulfill the promises he made. And he said it felt like Trump was prioritizing the economy over safety during the pandemic.
This is the United States of America. We can rebound. However, like, we can't just, like, reproduce people like our family members. Like, I can't get another mom. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I can't, like, replace these people. Like, I just question, like, whether he cared about us.
It's interesting, Sam. Joe Biden has spent a lot of time in Pennsylvania the past few months, but specifically in these white counties that President Trump had won by large margins. And obviously, and Biden has said this, that, you know, if his campaign can cut into those margins even a little bit, it would make a difference.
Exactly. But we're also talking about places Hillary Clinton won in 2016 that Biden wants to do even better in. Across the state, right outside Philadelphia, I talked to Jane Scilavati. She's a special education teacher. And back in 2016, she basically saw the election as trying to pick between the lesser of two evils.
In the end, on a last-minute decision, I pulled the lever for Trump.
She kind of regretted it right away. But her doubts accelerated as the pandemic raged on.
The more and more I watched him speak and blame other people, the more I realize that I'm not quite sure we're looking at a full deck here.
Scilavati is going to vote for Biden this year. She even cut an ad with the teachers union about why she's supporting him.
Can't change what you did, right? You can just move forward and try and do what you can to sway people the other way.
Does this seem like a permanent political realignment or just a reflection of this political moment that we're in right now? I mean, are these voters more or less becoming Democrats, or is this just a referendum on the president?
Yeah, so I actually asked everyone I talked to this question, and I heard a lot of different answers. So I want to introduce you to two lifelong Republicans in Michigan, Mitch Monin.
I pulled lever for Ronald Reagan.
And Jeanette Phillips.
In my 20s, I joined the Republican Party as a lifetime member. It was very expensive to do, but I felt committed.
And since 2016, both have become more and more dissatisfied with Trump. Monin is a business owner, former Army Ranger. He voted for the Libertarian in 2016. He has a son who's disabled, and Trump's behavior has really gotten to him. Remember that moment on the campaign where Trump mocked a disabled reporter?
So in this case, I'm going to be voting for Vice President Biden, not because I agree with his policies. I vehemently disagree with quite a few of them. But I truly believe that at his core, that he is a fundamentally decent human being.
Both Monin and Phillips didn't like Trump's rhetoric when it came to the protests over racial injustice. She's voting for Biden for other reasons, too.
The Republicans have blown the deficit up. They don't care about the livelihoods of people who've lost their jobs. I lost my job 3 weeks ago myself. You know, they're clueless, I think, to what's going on.
Would you call yourself a Democrat now, or is it you are fighting back against Donald Trump until he is out of office?
I don't think I can vote for Republican for the next 10 years. There has to be payback for what has just happened these last 4 years.
Not only that, but this lifelong Republican is now donating to the local Democratic Party and is signed up to be a Democratic precinct delegate with her daughter. Monin is now proudly displaying a Biden sign in his yard. It's a big deal for him. But he doesn't see this as some kind of long-term shift. If the Republican Party can step back and take a hard look in the mirror, should Trump lose, he says.
I do believe that this is a vote of this moment. It is singular in nature.
And Audie, here's a part of the conversation that really stuck with me. Everyone I talked to viewed this political moment as historic and recognized the weight of their votes, but Monin actually asked for a copy of the full interview we did so he could send it to his daughter as a kind of historical record of this time.
40 years from now, people are going to ask, what were you doing? I truly think this is a watershed moment for us as a country, as a democracy. And the ability to be able to have her share that and have her children listen to that, I think, would be a pretty cool thing.
Sam Greenglass, thanks for your reporting.
Thanks, Audie.
Peace, quiet, and good order will be maintained in our city to the best of our ability. Riots, melees, and disturbances of the peace are against the interest of all our people and therefore cannot be permitted.
The jury found that they were all not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty, not guilty.
Make it rough. Not guilty, the guilty. Devils try to kill me. When the news gets to the hood, the niggas will be hotter than cayenne pepper. Bust, kicking up dust is a must.
How concerned should we be about the possibility of political violence after Election Day? Some experts are watching online chatter and see some people arguing for people to show up armed at the polls. NPR's Tim Mack has more.
Far-right militia-style groups are busy this year. Their numbers are growing, their online chatter is increasing, and their threats are becoming more specific. Megan Squire is a computer science professor at Elon University who studies right-wing extremism and online spaces.
I would say the heat in the conversations that I observe, the heat is higher, the vitriol is greater.
A mosaic of groups on the far right with different goals agree on one thing, that President Trump can only lose if the election is rigged. Hampton Stahl is the founder of Militia Watch, a blog that tracks the right-wing militia movement.
So there's circulation of rumors of left-wing intervention at the polls or in the election, which has led to individuals and militia groups discussing primarily showing up armed at the polls to see if there's anything suspicious or what they deem suspicious.
A patchwork of federal and state laws against voter intimidation exists to protect the process. And voting rights activists say that even if there is an increased risk of militia activity, it is important to keep it in perspective. The risk, says Jerry Hebert of the Campaign Legal Center, is that people may be afraid to go to the polls if there is too much hype around militia rhetoric.
It is designed to maybe keep people from showing up because they fear that there might be some activity when in fact it's just a chilling commentary.
But the commentary and planning is getting harder to track online. Cassie Miller, a senior research analyst at the Southern Poverty Law Center, says that while Facebook and Twitter have cracked down on these groups, they've moved the conversation to other places.
You know, it becomes a lot harder for people like me and my colleagues to track them because we watch them kind of splinter into other places.
Other places like fringe social media networks that are more permissive of their content and to discussion boards where militia members can meet and organize. It's hard to predict how much online threats could spill into real-world violence, but there are efforts to assess the risk of militia activity. ACLED, a crisis mapping project, teamed up with Militia Watch to map out potential hotspots for militia-style activities around the elections. The report, exclusively obtained by NPR, looks at states where militias have had recruitment drives and training, where they have cultivated relationships with law enforcement, and where there have been substantial engagement in anti-coronavirus lockdown protests. They assess that 5 states, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Oregon, have the highest risk of seeing increased militia activities around the elections. Everything from demonstrations to potential violence. Stahl, who worked on this report, said one of the reasons he is so alarmed now is because of how the members of militias are talking.
There's a lot more sort of worst-case scenario thinking that is leading to fantasizing about like violence and like very real militarized action that hasn't really been as widespread in the militia movement as it is now.
The threats by militia-style groups have been growing in number, vitriol, and specificity, culminating in events like the alleged plot by 6 men in Michigan to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer. All of this adds to tensions in an already deeply contested and divisive election season. Tim Mack, NPR News, Washington. Looking for survival. The devil made you a slave and he gave you a Bible. 400 years of getting our ass kicked by so-called Christians and Catholics. But I'ma watch them burn in the fire. See, I'm a G, that's why I ain't in your choir. Cause I see, cause I know. The church ain't nothing but a fashion show. Get the devil to a 187 and they won't call me a nigga when I get to heaven.
We've now got the story of one family in Loudoun County, Virginia. It involves a lost burial ground now found, a national reckoning over race, and a drowning. Here's Daniela Cheslow of member station WAMU.
Pastor Michelle Thomas walks into a forest in Loudoun County, Virginia, to the grave of her son.
My son is the first African-American person who was born free to be buried in this cemetery.
Thomas's son is named Fitz, and I'll tell you more about how he died later. But where he's buried is its own story. 5 years ago, Thomas says she was looking for a new site for her church when, in county records, she saw a listing called Belmont Slave Cemetery.
I saw it on a cemetery index, and so I just literally saw the points on a plot, and I just went through the woods to find it.
She found unmarked rocks in the ground at the ends of long, narrow depressions in the soil. Thomas persuaded the owners of the land to donate it. She got Boy Scouts to pave trails into the forest, and she counted 44 graves, though she thinks there's more. It bothers her that the county has known about this cemetery since at least the 1850s.
All that paperwork existed. We just had no one that was interested or demanding that this history be told.
Then, this past June, the historical project became personal for Thomas. Her son was swimming with friends in a tributary of the Potomac River when he drowned. Fitz's death baffled family and friends. Here's Phil Thompson, former president of the Loudoun NAACP.
Fitz was a strong athlete, a young kid, swimming all his life. I live in that neighborhood. The creek was maybe 20, 30 yards, so it shouldn't have been a tough swim.
The Loudoun County Sheriff's Office is investigating the drowning. Emergency crews took nearly 40 minutes to reach the scene. An incident review by authorities in both Virginia and Maryland found that even though Fitz was swimming in Virginia, cell towers routed 911 calls to the Maryland side of the Potomac.
Loudoun County 911, what is your emergency?
Please get down here. River Creek.
Operators struggled to locate the teen. Loudoun County Fire and Rescue Chief Keith Johnson says he's implementing changes that include new software to pinpoint the location of emergency callers and training dispatchers to listen better.
Obviously, it's a tragic event, and I believe we have done everything we can do to make the changes.
Those should have been implemented long before her son went swimming, Thomas says. Now she says she wants a say in the changes, and she wants compensation for what she believes is wrongful death. At a recent protest, she tied Fitz's death to the movement for racial justice.
Fitz's life matters with an S. It still matters.
And we're going to fight to change laws and change regulations and policy until all of us are protected. God bless you.
In Loudoun County, people are listening. Fitz died just days after George Floyd's killing drew more than 1,000 people to the streets here. The county's Confederate monument came down in July. On what would have been Fitz's 17th birthday weekend, Thomas led 200 people to his grave.
Let's have a moment of silence now.
There's no headstone yet. Just a rock that resembles the older graves nearby. Thomas leaned her arms on it and cried. She had rescued the cemetery from its long neglect, but no one had saved her son. For NPR News, I'm Daniela Cheslow.
I haven't beaten anyone this bad in a long time.
Archaeologists have made a startling discovery, a mass grave in Tulsa, what they believe to be the remains of victims of the 1921 race massacre there. At least 12 bodies in a spot the city had no record of anyone buried. Nearly a century ago, a white mob attacked and wiped out the area in Tulsa known as Black Wall Street. Experts estimate the mob killed as many as 300 African Americans and wounded some 800 more. Local coverage now. Sierra Pizarro of NBC station KJRH live on scene. Sierra, how's the city of Tulsa coming to grips with this?
This is an incredible moment for the Tulsa community, one that's acknowledged by Mayor G.T. Bynum today.
I'm thankful for the citizens of Tulsa who have reversed nearly a century of the conventional wisdom of this being something that we don't want to talk about and that we just want to put behind us and pretend like it never happened. This generation of Tulsans is not doing that.
Mayor Bynum visited this site yesterday, and today he's not the only one. Crowds have gathered all week here at Oaklawn Cemetery to watch the work being done here. Some say they're even surprised that the investigation has come to this point where they're actually digging up soil in search of the victims of the 1921 Tulsa race massacre. Descendants have even stopped by. One of them tells me he didn't know his family was impacted by the attack until later in life, and that's because his family, he says, was so traumatized by what happened. They didn't want to talk about it, Shep.
Yeah. Sierra Pizarro, thanks so much. With the excavation right behind her, let's turn to Dr. Carrie Stackelback. Carrie is an archaeologist at the University of Oklahoma working on the excavation and with us live. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
How stunned were people to find that this was there and no one had any clue?
Well, so I think absolutely it's definitely come as a surprise. It is not unusual to encounter unmarked graves in a cemetery, especially a historic cemetery, but certainly to have encountered this number of unmarked graves in the large trench that we've excavated is quite surprising, yes.
Carrie, you were just in a meeting, I understand, with descendants of the massacre victims. What did they say about this dig?
They have questions for us. They're clearly very interested. I think they're quite pleased with the fact that we have made this step and that we're making progress. But understandably, everybody is starting to ask questions about the next steps and where do we go from here.
What are the next steps? I mean, are they planning on exhuming the bodies or what?
That is, the next step is what we are going to propose, is that exhumation would be the appropriate thing for us to do. However, we have a series of logistical issues that we have to address in order to get to that point, and that will take us a certain amount of time for us to actually get through all of that, including getting the appropriate court order that would allow us to perform the exhumation. And then we would also want to make sure that we are appropriately addressing the need to maintain the preservation of those remains while we undertake the analyses, the specialized analyses that will allow us to confirm if, in fact, we are looking at race massacre victims.
Well, is there an idea about whether people will ever be identified? Is there a process that's reliable all these years later?
There is a process. So DNA is available for as one technique to try and identify.
If there's a match from way back then.
But that would be an extremely challenging process, and this we understand. And that's part of that logistical consideration that I referenced earlier has to do with that. One of those things is that we have to put together an appropriate strategy to actually try to even accomplish that. And there are a number of things that would have to be addressed in order to do so. Obtaining the samples from the skeletal remains is somewhat easier. Doesn't mean that it isn't itself complicated. But that is quite a bit easier than the other end of that, which is to then identify an individual who would provide a sample that can be identified as a match to our skeletal remains, especially when we're talking about multiple generations on.
Sure.
I gotta say one good thing. On another day.
Long live Al Sharpton. Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, October 24, 2020. So I have been told. This is our weekly broadcast, compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, observations, questions, suggestions to share. The number 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things to address before we get to the callers. We should be here tomorrow, Global Sunday Talk on Racism, Sunday afternoon, earlier than our normal broadcast time. So that would be 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Thought it would be important, really, to check in with folks different parts of the world with the U.S. presidential election looming, the Rona restrictions worldwide, lots of things happening on the planet. Thought it would be good to see what is happening, get their views. So that should be tomorrow in about 15, 16 hours or so, give or take. Let's see. What a week with all of the difficulties and problems in the world. Wow. I mean, just wow. Let's see. Some of the notes that I have. We had a listener who wrote in with something that I thought was pretty important. We've had a lot of parents call in, neutralizing workplace racism. We had just really important, use that word again, exchange between parents, just talking about having offspring who are in a college university setting and trying to find the balance. You know, how much autonomy do they have? How much assistance do you offer in terms of them rejecting counter-racist logic and not having appropriate suspicion of individuals classified as white? Really, I thought, important conversation. That was yesterday on neutralizing workplace racism. Revisiting that today, just from a slightly different perspective, but stay tuned, especially attempted parents. The section that talked about genealogy and how enforcement officers, that was a Canadian report, by the way, so enforcement officers around the world using databanks of
genetic material to solve cases, pursue suspects, that sort of thing. Wow, that is 21st century refinement of white supremacy racism. number one, before I even get to any other aspects of that report, if, you know, solving crimes, especially murder, if that is important, that's, hey, we are willing to devote maximum resources. There's no statute of limitations, right, for that crime. Okay, no problem. That's great. So with all of these lynching photographs, postcards, all the like, they got facial recognition technology. We should be able to identify, like, lots, if not all, of these white people, right? Let's get cracking. They go around and prosecute Nazis that are 100 years old and all the rest of it. Get you and your walker, your cane, breathing material, and scoot on into the courtroom, brother. That's what they got tons of court cases. That's not hyperbole, right? You can do the same thing with all of the race soldiers who have lynched and killed black people. Some of them bragged about it. You could do the exact same thing. Get cracking. Next, with that same report, I thought it was important. The white woman, they were talking and they said, well, how concerned are you about the accuracy of this technology? She said, I think it's incredibly accurate. And I said, whoa, pause right there. Any white person telling me that, do you all remember it was 2015? It was pretty major news. The FBI, Justice Department, they announced that they had literally hundreds of cases where the information was wrong, where they had one of their federal scientific experts with a capital E come in and testify, oh, such and such did this, and he raped her, and he did this, and we got DNA and fingernail data, and you see here, and you're too ignorant to understand, but I can explain it. And whoops, oh yeah, we were wrong. Yep, we just messed all that. Remember that? That was 2015, towards the end of the year, and they've had lots of that type of thing. I'm extremely suspicious anytime a white person, especially in that context, we're talking about some suspicious use of technology to pursue suspects. And you think this is foolproof? Oh, absolutely. Major point of suspicion. Next, they talked about, we had multiple segments where they talked about health. They had the segment where they talked about maternal mortality rates. One thing I will say at the very beginning, that was from WNYC, New York Public Radio. The suspected racist host, he said that they thought it was important. They had devoted the last few days to talking about issues dealing with racism, white supremacy. They raised this issue and they said, because this is not talked about in mainstream media outlets. False. There are lots of reports. We have played a number of them on the compensatory call-in, and I have pointed them out for years. I would say for at least 2 years now. They have reports in what I consider mainstream outlets, the New York Times, the LA Times, major outlet. And I mean, huge stories. Sometimes they'll be on the front page or at the top if you go to the digital site for these major newspapers. But they'll have tons of reports. I'm sure I could find at least 20 over the last 2 years mainstream outlets, NPR, as exactly what I just said, Al Jazeera, easily, CNN. I know this. They talk about this on a regular basis. I was, in fact, there were so many of these reports, I started to ask, like, wow, is there any suspicion? Like, why do we think they're focusing so much attention? It's not like they care about black mothers or black children. They're not, so they could have solved this problem. It's not like they're ignorant about this. They could have solved this problem a long time ago. Why are they focusing so much attention on this? I raised that question years ago. So, one, I thought that was false. Two, the white host asked the guest, Jamila Taylor, who I believe is a victim of racism. There was no video. But he asks her, he says, well, do you think training will help to solve this problem. I feel like any time a white person asks a victim of racism that type of question, they're practicing white supremacy racism. If you're white, you know white people better than any Negro on the plantation. You know your uncles, nieces, mothers, aunts, grandmothers. You know there is not enough Jane Elliott brown eyes, blue eyes nonsense in the universe to quit them from their racist jokes. Come on now. You know this. Why even ask that sort of stupid question? And I thought our current president just said, we're not doing any more of that white privilege, making white people feel bad, get that on out of here. Didn't that just happen? Maybe I don't keep up with the news. Number three, victims of racism. That's why I said often I despise when white people, when they interview a non-white person about racism so they can pretend they're ignorant about this subject and ask those type of questions. So he asked, now she's got to answer. And so she gives her response, well, I think maybe, and you did you hear? We had a little assist from Ice Cube in that one, O'Shea Jackson, great thespian. But did you hear the response? She was stumbling and fumbling, which, I mean, she's a victim of white supremacy. You know, you can get in trouble if you say the wrong thing. She can't say, what are you asking me that type of question for? Might get in trouble. Can't say that. So, I mean, what are you supposed to say? I told somebody that yesterday. Victims of racism, frequently we are required to lie. Can't even be honest with ourselves about things. Training is not going to solve this problem. Our president told you that. Let's see. They talked about the very first report that we aired. Catherine Flowers, man, she was talking about how they have the open sewage in Alabama. One, we talked about very beginning of the year, Harriet A. Washington, top 10. Man, I miss the good old days when we were reading quality literature. Case is the lamest book, second worst book ever. But we were reading Harriet A. Washington, A Terrible Thing to Waste. Oh, magnificent. But she talked about that exactly and the risk that black people face. Deliberately so. Places like Loudoun County. I also thought it was a deliberate act of white supremacy racism. That segment was from NPR. And they did not include, oh, this just happens to be the infamous Bloody Loudouns. That's what they called it in Alabama because of the terrorism against black people. Maybe there's a connection between Bloody Loudouns and now we got open sewage where they're getting cholera and all these diseases that they say are in a third world country, so-called, and makes you more susceptible to the Rona. NPR doesn't know about Bloody Loudouns, really? I'm more informed about Alabama state history than the folks at NPR. Get out of here. Stop it. Ah. Deliberate act of white supremacy racism, in my view, not giving total context. And that's another one where I just pause for the folks who say, I think they're lying about the Rona. I think they're lying about the Rona. And people who said, I think they're lying about the black maternal mortality rates and infant mortality rates. When I hear reports like that, that I'm pretty sure are true. I haven't been to Alabama recently, but I'm pretty sure that that report about the open sewage and all that, I have reason to suspect that that's accurate. Even if the Rona has been, if they have fabricated some of the data, there's overwhelming evidence for me to conclude black people are not in a healthy environment because of white supremacy racism. And as I said, the evidence abounds. Harriet A. Washington, two times. Medical apartheid, A Terrible Thing to Waste. Next. Oh, man. The segment on the cemetery. That was at the towards the end there, right after the segment on the excavation in Tulsa, which they probably knew about that gravesite in Tulsa as well. Those reports were sequenced together for a reason. Did you hear what they said? They were talking to Pastor Michelle Thomas in Virginia, the Coon Man, and she said that they knew, white people, they knew that this black cemetery was there, she said, from the 1800s. 1850s to be exact, so we're talking almost 200 years. This is what they call antebellum history before the Civil War. tell me again, what is it that they, we're just ignorant, you know, I'm just as ignorant and retarded as can be. I don't know nothing about racism, can't even spell racism. Isn't that what they say? Isn't every single white guest that we have come on this program, who's more ignorant about racism? Oh man, white people, gee whiz, we're the most ignorant people ever. Do they have remedial classes on racism? Who are the people who knew about the nigger cemetery for the last 200 years? The Coon Man. That's not a mistake. That's not an accident. That's not Virginia is some sort of anomaly. That's the whole world. Obviously, who is going to be more informed about the plantation? Use logic. Now, they said they're talking to Pastor Michelle Thomas, and she finds out this information about the cemetery and all that. And then they deviate to her son, and he drowned. I said, now, wow. How many reports have we had on the cows about black people dying, getting access to swimming? It's tons of them. I mean, just from the book club alone. That's in Serena and Venus Williams' father, Richard Williams, Black and White, The Way I See It. He talked about that exactly. We had white guests who came on and talked about they bombed the swimming pools to keep black people out. That's in the book we're reading right now, Second Worst Book Ever. But that is in the book we're reading right now, Cased, how they bombed swimming pools and filled them with cement just to make sure no Negroes in the pool. Didn't they start the Chicago race riot? Black child killed in the pool. I mean, you could have whole books. They do have whole books. A white man wrote a whole book about racism and swimming pools in this part of the world. Like, it is staggering. Even the incident in McKinney, that's in Cased that we're reading right now. It is staggering. What made it worse when I heard that report about what happened to her son, Fitz Campbell Thomas, who died at 16, the man not nest double entendre, died at 16. So they're talking about her son and how he died, he drowns, and I thought, man, this is like suspicious for like more reasons than I can count. The 911 call got routed incorrectly, so he goes to the way wrong hospital where you have to drive to the other side of the state, and all this they have to change. I mean, what? Everything about that, like, did they just kill her? That's what I was thinking. Like, did they just kill her son and call it a drowning? And oh yeah, we messed up, it was an accident. Yeah, we forgot about the nigger cemetery, we forgot about this nigger child. Like, yeah, we just, it's Virginia, you know, what can you expect? Blame it on the Coon Man. We make it, I mean, what? Everything about it was just, even though they do have whole books. We did have Alondra Nelson on the program. That's in her book about the Black Panther Party. They started an ambulance service because that type of thing was happening. What is it? Standard operating procedure for the ambulance to not arrive at all, or for them to take 5 hours to get to you, or for them to go to the wrong hospital, or lots of exactly what you just heard with her son. Not that I don't think that could have happened, but just, wow. Was it just, if I'm, you know, being ignorant, it's Saturday, it's been a stressful year, my brain computer might be working incorrectly, metaphor, let me know. But it just sounded like, wow, did they just kill her child? And oh yeah, nigga drowned, I'm sorry. Swimming lessons, man. System of racism, white supremacy, 16 years old. As soon as possible. We did have a parent who wrote in. We had lots of Ice Cube for people who, I guess, don't check the news this week. The election is coming up. FOMO years. The election is coming up. I saw a report. I thought it might have been fake news at first, but I saw it repeated, so maybe it's real. They said Ice Cube was chastised, called a coon and all the rest, because he was reportedly in some sort of talks, or might have been in talks with President Trump about a plan for black people in the states. And people were outraged. And what is this? A ploy to get black votes and all the rest? You coon. So I'm just looking at, like I said, I thought this was fake news at first. Like, did they get me? Wait a minute. Is this the Onion? What's going on here? And so I checked. I said, O'Shea Jackson? Is that who they're talking about? Is this, like, legitimate? And so I checked. CNN had tons of reports, if that means anything. And so I kept seeing this. I said, so if our current president is reelected, is it for real going to be a part of the narrative that Ice Cube is partly to blame? In the year of the Rona, with all of this, if Donald Trump gets reelected, like a sentence in the like pages of explanation for why this may happen is going to have to include O'Shea Jackson from NWA fame. I said black people some kind of way they get blamed every presidential election. I even pitched that years ago. I pitched that as a report to write about to black people because it's so predictable. But I mean, Ice Cube, not Cornel West, not Kanye West, not President Obama. Niggas with parent who wrote in. I do not have children. Hi, Gus. I just wanted to share an interaction with my preteen female offspring. We were discussing films she likes. Boys in the Hood? Are we there yet? She pointed out that she enjoys films like Princess and the Frog and The Lion King. I pointed out some racist things in both movies. This caused her to cry uncontrollably. I had to comfort her. She asked me, why does everything have to involve race? This caused me to question my approach with my offspring. Was I wrong to just inform her of my views? I am still learning. I have told her that my views are to help her think. I ask her about her views, but if I disagree with her, she gets upset. This basically shuts communication down. She is 12, and I just started learning about the system of white supremacy during the past 3 years. Before this time, I was extremely confused about racism. I think I passed this confusion down to my offspring. My questions for the listeners, parents, listen closely. You cannot spectate. If we have attempted parents, go ahead, listen closely. Need a response here. All right, questions for parent listeners, should be parents. What has worked for them when it comes to teaching a preteen about racism? Say that one again for parents. What has worked for them when it comes to teaching a preteen about racism? Next, how can I correct the years of confusion? Thank you all in advance for your views. Wowee. Great questions. If we have attempted parents, no spectating. The number, 720-716-7300. The code, 564-943, pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. No spectating from parents. One thing I will say, I do not have children. One thing I can say is I've heard consistently from parents, some of them callers to this program and just parents in general, being honest with them, I am still learning. I am still confused about racism, white supremacy, and working on that myself. So I think sharing that with your child, that if I have a different view than you do about something, it might not be that I'm correct, because I'm not always right about things on racism, white supremacy. I'm trying to use logic. I'm encouraging and really trying to teach you how to use logic when looking at things, you know. And it can just be present. Hey, I have concluded the racism thing. Oh, yeah. And it's been my experience just when and being around children. I can say this, being around children, the preteen children, 12 and under, that, man, if you just allow them to be honest, like they can ask questions, they can state their view about things. Ooh-wee. the racism is generally so flagrant, they will start to see a whole lot of things, especially if you watch television, like, oh yeah, just hang out with them for a few hours or what have you, and they will start to pick out a lot of things. But it doesn't have to be about, you know, agreement. Just, you know, pick out something and ask questions. The same thing that we talk about in the workplace and what have you, asking questions to kind of see if it's something about a movie, The Princess Frog or what have you. What did you think about the film? Blah, 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 blah. Oh, okay. I might not even give my view. I might just ask a question. I'd have to switch and use a movie. I haven't seen Princess Frog in some time. But just asking if there are black characters in the film, asking how those characters function. Ask how those characters function in relation to the white characters. You don't even have to make it a skin tone thing at first. You can just use the characters' names, like, you know, this Doughboy's character in the film. How did he function? What's he doing? You know, does that seem like a character you would want to be? I feel like that's always a good question. Which character in this movie, what have you, would you want to be? And why? See what they say. Oh, okay. That's interesting. Just asking questions. And again, like I said, just being honest, because I could be wrong. You know, it might be sometimes I make mistakes. Sometimes that does happen, right? The child is correct and the parent is wrong. So it could be. We'll just see, though. But I found when you can just kind of encourage that open dialogue, they can share their view. They're not going to be fussed at and yelled at, that type of thing. And you can ask questions. Ooh-wee. I have found that asking question component, because sometimes that gets the using logic. I might have to think as opposed to just saying what I want. If you've asked me a question, I might have to think a few seconds, use a little bit of logic. But I don't have children. So we will get to the folks who dialed in. Again, parents, no spectating. I'm so sorry that this happened, though. It's been a very rough year, and racism causes, you know, so much trauma on so many levels. But yeah, we will check in with folks who are on the phone line, and parents, no spectating. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Oh, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Bay Area mom.
Thank you. Greetings to you and the callers. Okay, first question. What preteen?
Preteen 11, 12.
You, Gus, I remember one thing that worked for me. You created a program, program on this program for the children, and they were to watch Imagine That and find the racism in the movie, and what I remember is my son finding the how they kind of emasculated Eddie Murphy in that movie. So maybe with the movies, if you were to have them find, just look for different things in the movies and then have them show you, because after that, he started doing it with every movie. So I think Big Mama's House had a two. And so he's, oh my God, they emasculated it. If you do it like that, so have them respond to you, it doesn't seem like you're just, everything is about race. Well, it is, but it doesn't seem as if it's you pushing the narrative. How do you reverse the damage or fix the damage? It's trial and error. What I do is I just admit when I'm incorrect. I wasn't right. You know, so that's what I do. I just admit when I'm incorrect. And that's about it. I have, they're not preteens anymore, but it was real tricky when they were at that age, 11 and 12, particularly my daughter was very white identified, but I had to take her to the Muslim school. That helped a lot. But with my son, television is not great. Television is not okay. television is awful. It programs the children. I'm a behavior technician, and I have three-year-olds, and I noticed that the programming from YouTube, because the parents are giving the devices to the children and they go straight to YouTube, they're programming them with whatever it is they're watching. So you got to kind of really monitor that television. And I think that's, I'll leave it there so other people can say something too, and I'll mute my line. And if I have something to say, I'll just pop in or ask if I can say something.
Much obliged. We did. We actually had several broadcasts where we had younger, I guess preteen, a lot of times it was folks who were 10, 9, 8. That was the thought process in having Justice on the pro, even though she is way far beyond preteen now. But that was the logic in having her on the program at that time, to say that, hey, if you use words that are age appropriate, they can understand logic. Most people can grasp logic. It's that we get encouraged with the, what did I say earlier today? The lying. There's so much of that. That's how this system operates. And victims of white supremacy, we have to lie to ourselves and then lie to our offspring. Ooh-wee. One thing I did think of. The movie idea is great, though, to asking questions. And I love the way that she explained it, though, telling them, giving them something in advance to look out for. That way they can use their brain computer so they can be more active in thinking as they watch and not just sitting there dully entertained, because they're going to make a report, even if it's just verbal, they're making a report afterwards. So yeah, I have seen, and I mean, it was a lot that is in the archives, because I think we did that more than once. We did like Madagascar 2 and some others, and I mean, they were pulling out lots of information. I remember we did the one about Madagascar 2, which is set in Brazil, all those COVID cases right now. It was set in Brazil, and I asked them, I said, did you see any black people? And they said, no. I said, do you think there are any black people in Brazil? That's where this is taking place at, Rio. Do you think there are any black people there? I'm like, I don't know. It didn't look like it, probably. Or you can go back. I'll post it. You can look back. But, yeah, fascinating opportunity for educational moments like that. But one thing before we get to the other folks, truth. The caller who wrote in, who is a vegan, plant-based diet, she said her child asked a question, a very important question. All questions are, but ooh. Her child said, sobbing, is everything about race? You talk about an educational project right there. Man, oh. I am so glad that you asked that question. We are going to blow that up, put that on a poster board, and we are going to spend the next, if you're homeschooling, ooh-wee, that is going to be our project. We could spend the next 5 years, any subject matter that comes up, what are you interested in? Aerotechnology. Oh, wow, let's study, and then let's see if racism pops there. What are you interested in studying? Environment. Wow. Oh, okay. You're into all of that, being healthy. Let's see if racism pops up there. And we just go on. Any subject matter, any part of the world, anything that comes up, great. Let's study when you get interested in something. Why don't we see any black people cooking when we go out to the restaurant? That's interesting. Let's see if this has anything to do. This could be a lifelong project. I'm not even going to answer. We will just study. And then you can come to a conclusion to yourself, because every question has an answer, and that one for sure has an answer. We might not like the answer, but hey, every question has an answer. We will spend some time. So is everything about race? And if it is, then what? Should we ignore it? Should we not talk about it anymore? Should we try to solve this problem? Another question. That could be another great conversation. We can think about that, but she did ask. Ooh-wee. I think if you asked, man, you should get an answer. Is everything about Rand? That's one you should answer for yourself. But I don't have children. Other parents. Retired firefighter in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes. I'll first start off by saying that that question was a great start for that parent. And you have already explained some reasonings on why that's important. Dr. Welsing was known for a, I think what she said was an African quote that says, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I also would say that most of us start off in a deficit. The most dynamic propaganda system amongst people the world has ever known is the global system of racism, white supremacy. And most of us do not have a plan, extensive plan, I put it that way, before we even make the choice of producing children, including myself. And so therefore, we even start with a even more dynamic deficit with our children. I heard one parent mention about the television. The television is the one of the sources that is entered into the place where you're allowed to stay at. That is one of the main ways and means that the white supremacists spread their poison. Well, that's a metaphor. Spread their propaganda. And of course, to a younger mind, they're going to be absorbing all of this information, which would be against what you're trying to oppose upon the child in a constructive way. So it's to be expected, but you can, based on the questions as was stated, the problem can be fixed. My experiences, I was involved from trying to have understandings and methods on solving the problem of racism, white supremacy by working with groups of that nature before my offspring was born. And basically, I actually had to go through the court systems to be able to get some sort of attachment with him. And in turn, I was granted full custody of him by the time that he was 12, 13 years old. And basically, he was, you know, always with me all of the time. And from observation, it basically somewhat is not perfect. And I'm not perfect, definitely, but it's not perfect. But I do have an operational relationship with him, and from my observance with him and who he associates with, I haven't seen a white person yet, let alone talking about some sort of direct influences, which I do know that we all in some sort of way influenced by white people. But don't get discouraged. It could get fixed. And as I mentioned before, the question that your child asks is a great start. DCS program, we started our first session today. For the most part, it was handing out the equipment, shirts, caps, safety on COVID-19 safety, and some of the entry level documents. As far as a substantial list of what should be my responsibilities as a member of the care group that I'm associated with, as far as helping out with the chores, the daily work part, what am I capable of doing? We have children as young as 7 years old up to the age of 17, and based on that level, everybody has some sort of responsibilities that they're supposed to perform. to be effectively a part of that care group. That's just one of the things. I'm not going to go into much more extensive than that. I'm going to go, because of time, I'm going to go in with my last report. As I think I heard Gus mention, and most of the callers probably understand that Mr. O'Shea Jackson was being literally criticized by a number of non-white people in his actions. One of them happened to be someone that I literally grew up with, and no arguments. That's against the code. I'm not going to argue. What I did, I put it in terms of a question. I asked him, what non-white person is qualified or is not qualified to have a plan on solving the problem of racism, white supremacy? And it just left it at that. He called me back, which I had a good idea that he was going to call me back, and he gave some sort of cryptic meaning, but he didn't mention it any person at all on to my question on qualification, if that concern. That's why Mr. Fuller has in his code, in his version, understanding of counter-racist codification, VGQ, because we're all qualified to have an opinion. And if we can institute that to where we think is best, then do it. We're all qualified to do that. And up until so far, nobody, no matter what name that anybody can come up with, it has, as a non-white person, has came up with an answer to this problem. So anybody who wants to make a attempt to do so, it should not be incorrect for them to attempt to do so. And the word qualifications should not be brought into the discussion, and that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Context of white supremacy. Number again, 720-716-7300. The code 564-943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. No name calling. That is, I said that more frequently of late. Just people, for years I've heard people say, oh man, Mr. Fuller, something, Dr. Fuller, you know, Dr. Fuller, man, right on, that brother Fuller is, wow, he's have all this reverence. Like, okay, so if everybody had all this reverence for him, it's very rare. Like, Malcolm X doesn't have a list of like 10 things black people need to do right now, I don't think. Like, we didn't read that in the autobiography. If he does, I would like to know what's on his 10. But like, generally, most folks do not have a list of 10. Like the Black Panther Party, that they have a 10-point program, but most of the time it won't be like a explicitly stated list of, bam, work against racism, these 10 things. No name calling is in that list. Like, of Mr. Fuller has written books, plural, and talks all this time, blah, 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 and do this, blah, blah, blah. I don't even think no sex with white people is in the 10 stops. Is my memory bad? I don't even think that's in the 10 stops. But no name calling. Now think about that. We have to have have rules to stop people from talking about sexual intercourse between white people and non-white people on this here Saturday program. I don't think that's in the 10 stops. No name calling is. We have to have rules about that. Have to mute people. Because, in fact, that happened. I posted that. I was posting about Isabel Wilkerson, and I haven't called her any names the entire time we've read a book. Second worst book ever. Not one single name. I was posting, quoting from the text, and people started calling her names, and I generally just delete, unfriend, keep it moving. Why are you listening to the cows if you like name calling black people? I've said consistently, that is not no name calling. So I just post that. And even that is, hey. Sometimes, what did something, I said, name calling black people, even O'Shea Jackson, does not solve any problems. That's what the business we are supposed to be about, solving problems without creating new problems. I had folks get on there and write back, well, not name calling black people, that doesn't solve any problems either. All right. I'm not going to save HEQ on that one. Unfriend. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary, proceed.
Have you heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
I really hate that book. I really do. It's worse than the hate you did. So I disagree with you. At least that was a good story. We broke it down. We can break it down how we want, but the story was at least like, hey, I want to see what's going to happen next. This here is like, I just wish this ends this week. technology, facial recognition. When you read the definition, because we're talking about computers, not people. These computers, of course, are programmed by people. Most of the people that's programming these things are racist. And they work off of a streamlined logic. So the way a computer would identify a black person is by defining the word black and defining the word person. So if you walk into a store where you purchase things using facial recognition technology, blah, 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 or the cameras are watching people as they walk in, and you're black, they're already going to use the definition, calamitous, felon. It's like it's set up for a total failure just for the white supremacy to be so further refined that the white supremacists will have absolutely nothing to, like, it's not us, you know, it's the algorithms. They'll have the ultimate way out. Also, they got gesture recognition. They got the cameras now. They measure you. So even if they can't catch your face, they measure your shoulder length, your leg length, and they're able to pretty much pinpoint as you based off of the measurements. There's so many different ways they have it. A lot of cities are. In fact, the city that's making them, San Francisco, they banned them. But, you know, they're selling them to other cities, the companies. Kamala Harris bill to stop black women from dying during childbirth. I believe in the thing, and I could be wrong. I thought I heard $25 million. And I said, wow, that's all it would take? $25 million to fix this dastardly problem that we face? Of course, the training. How can you train people to not give circumcisions to black women who don't need them? Like, they're doctors. They know better. They're just racist, you know, and it becomes the policy at these hospitals, unfortunately. White-wing militias. The only people to engage in violence during this whole year that I've seen do it consistently has been the left-wing militias. And they, if you notice, the news doesn't talk about that. We got the Antifa groups. We got these young white people with Black Lives Matter shirts that just pop up in cities all around the country. They revamped the Students for a Democratic Society on a lot of campuses going back to like 2016. So a lot of this is the left-wing extremists. And if you think about it, it started this during the 2015 campaign to disrupt the rallies, to confront the people as they left the Trump rallies, and we see fights in the parking lot. And, of course, the media doesn't focus on it. They pacify them as just being young and not liking Trump, and it's okay not to like Trump, so it's okay for them to go and punch someone in the face that has a MAGA hat on. And then we get Charlottesville, where the media totally leaves out the white people with the piss, the white leftists with the piss projectiles, and just focus on the right wing ones. They call them white supremacists. But wait a minute, you had two groups of white people with guns and with piss projectiles and signs and flags. I mean, it was total chaos, but they only focused on one group. Then you look at the George Floyd riots, so well organized and coordinated that I know, and I hope this isn't anti-black, but I can pretty much guarantee that black people didn't do this, just based off of the level of coordination and organization. But someone could show me an example of something that black people coordinate and organize that works, that function, that well, nationwide, at the same time, the same tactics, the same, it's impossible for, well, it's not impossible for us to do it, but I know we're not doing it. And Seattle, Portland, Minneapolis, that is not the white wing extremists. So I just don't agree with how they're painting that picture. I hope that's a metaphor. I don't agree with how they're creating a narrative that these white supremacists that are white wing are the only white supremacists in the country. No, they're the only ones doing performing violence. In fact, the four people dead in the Chad Zone in Seattle were black. No white people got killed in Seattle. Impossible, you know. So the liberals are just as racist. California City, this is Compton, begins handing out free cash to address inequalities for black people. So they create a program in Compton. They give in these black people to confront, I think it's 800 or something residents. They're giving up to $1,000 each a month. I don't know if it's a month or every 2 weeks. They didn't lay out the specifics of that part, but this is to address racial inequality. In air quotes, I have. This is called universal basic income. This is a huge part of the technology I was talking about earlier. Because once they could put you on a fixed income that they control, then you can't do these things to get it. And they have, you know, and that's what they have in China. So this is called universal basic income. And this is bad, but they're doing it in Compton. Joe Biden is not winning the white vote. I played one game on my phone called Golf Clash. And you have these different groups, and you could join, and I don't join anymore. I just like to play to kill time, certain things. But all of these people are called MAGA 2020. You know, I haven't seen, I went to the Joe, see if anyone's over 1,000 clans named after Trump. It was two named after Biden, and one of them was called Lock Up Biden and Hunter Biden. This is a app that's, I think, the second most, or largest app on the App Store. So, Lawrence County, these black people have the sewage that runs out of their house, and their pipes are fine. However, the white areas, pipes run under their land, and when they bust, and that stuff comes up, it's messing up the black people's stuff, and the white people are refusing to repair it. This was a UN report when they showed it, and I'm sad to see that still happening. Children, as per the caller, the person who wrote in, the TV has been a problem for me. Shows that used to come on when my kids were preteens or teens, Nickelodeon and Disney, they would teach some, not cartoons, I'm talking about actual shows. They would teach them to make adult decisions without adults. They would show them all constantly in scenarios where they had to make adult decisions with no adults present to help them. And they would be in a living arrangement where their parents weren't around. Well, if the parents were around, the parents were a complete idiot. They were the comedy relief for the show. So don't trust your parents' judgment. And I noticed my children trying to make a lot of decisions without me and my wife's input. And I've said that this is a part of that. Also, for myself, I generally, and I know this is my code, I generally talk very bad about white people in the household. I talk bad about all people, all non-black people, but I talk bad about white people, and my kids get used to it. And a lot of things, as they older, they've seen it, because I knew that logic told me that y'all was going to experience. So by me constantly talking about it, even though you don't want to hear it. It always comes to, hey, I need to talk to you about something. And I've gotten that quite a lot from my oldest daughter, especially, who went to college, who yesterday asked me for $30. Like, what book? She was like, the Delectable Negro. I said, what? You know? So, wow, you know, so she's, you know, but that's been my position. I really don't care what my kids think about how I talk about racism or that I bring everything to back to white people. I don't care how my family thinks about lost family members because of it. So what? All right. And then those same family members will call me up when something racist happens to them. Hey, how can I handle this? So I've noticed that. So I keep consistent with it, and I think you should do the same thing. Very lastly, Gus, Ice Cube, why are you... They did the same thing to Kanye, like, because he wanted to run for president. He's a coon. Like, seriously? Ice Cube explains himself very eloquently on various shows that one party said, we'll get back to you later. The Democrats, the Republicans said, we could move some of this stuff into our platform. And I saw him on a show with black women on Fox. It was like Fox Ethnic or something. It was black women on Fox Soul. And had like Lisa Ray and Claudia Jordan and Vivica Fox. And I mean, he was explaining this thing so perfectly. Like, you know, I'm not about politics. I'm just about getting something done for black people. So I made this plan. I don't care who looks at it. And they just ripped him. It was like, no, using no logic. You know, we don't like Trump. And I noticed that it's been this election right here is going to be so divisive because a lot of black men are just not feeling Biden. Has nothing to do with them liking Trump. They just don't want to support Biden. And black females are very angry about this. And I just see this being a long, lingering thing. And I think they're setting us up to be the scapegoat for Biden losing, like they set up black people in the last election, who went out 88% to support Hillary. You played the clip earlier where white women went out and supported Trump at like 53-something percent. He would have won the election. So that's it, Gus.
Much obliged. Killing time, ripped him, scapegoat, metaphor. I'm going to download the Golf Clash app on my phone just so that I can join the Lock Up Biden group. I thought that report about the white voters was folly for many reasons, but yeah, the confirmation, we'll see. We have 2 weeks or whatever it is, we'll see. Lock Up Biden, that's they had some new crafty nicknames. They were talking about Crooked Hillary and all that. Yeah, one more years. I think I did see at least one or two of the reports where victim of racism O'Shea Jackson, he did give his reasoning, and exactly as you said, you know, anybody, if they want to look at it and what have you, fine. I'm just trying to solve a problem. Logical there, no problem. Like racial focal pointing. The racist is Trump. Just Trump? Really? Logic. Four more years. But I do think there's going to be a lot of blaming and all of that just... We're in a system of white supremacy. Black people are to blame for the... Woof, man, oh man. Let's see. Other folks who dial... Again, if we have parents, if you have thoughts, we had a attempted parent asking questions. If you are a parent and have thoughts on the questions about how to deal with sharing honest information about the world in which we live... Racism, white supremacy, especially like preteens, so 12, right in there, 12, 11. Feel free, dial in the number 720-716-7300. The code 564 #943. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Before I check in and see if folks have anything else, there was, I normally don't do a lot of CNN watching, just bias, I don't know, whatever it is. Maybe it might even be my implicit Atlanta bias, since their headquarters is down there. So I don't root for the Braves, and I don't watch CNN. I don't root for the Hawks. Like, boo, Atlanta. But CNN, they had a report in Mississippi, more white people now have gotten COVID-19 than African Americans. Attitudes about masks might help explain why, officials say. Now, I thought, wow, because some folks had even called in and said they hadn't really seen reports saying white people specifically, and they're being afflicted by the Rona, and blah, blah, blah. And so, I mean, to get like a reversal, so I just said, I'll make sure to share. So I'll read a little bit. For the longest time in this pandemic, coronavirus has infected and killed more African Americans in Mississippi than white people, which experts explained in part by pointing to racial health disparities, white supremacy, in one of the most impoverished states. Early on, black Mississippians accounted for roughly 60% of the state's cases and deaths, in the state health department says. But the tide has turned in the Magnolia State. Just as the country is seeing a resurgence in COVID-19 cases, Mississippi is too. That was the word encased yesterday, resurgence of race. Just as the country is seeing a resurgence in COVID-19 cases, Mississippi is too, but now with cases among white people leading the way. Like, that's direct, right? Whites surpassed African Americans in Mississippi's overall reported COVID-19 death toll around September 21st for the first time since the state health department started published data by race in June. The same happened with total COVID-19 cases around October 14. Both categories then are aligning closer to the state's overall population, 59.1% white, 37.8% black. While several factors may be at play, the state health official suggests one in particular. He thinks large segments of the white population aren't social distancing and wearing masks as a wholeheartedly as much as the black community has been recently. As far as the case trends, we have had really pretty good uptake by a lot of folks in the black community with masking and social distancing, State Health Officer Dr. Thomas Dobbs told reporters when asked about an uptake in white cases. We've worked very aggressively to make sure that the black community understand where the risks are and what can be done to prevent that. And I just will say, I think big parts of the white community, especially in areas that maybe weren't as hard affected previously, have not been as compliant were engaged actively with social distancing and masking, and I think that does make a difference. I will stop there. Now, that could be fake news. I don't like CNN. But not that it's about liking. I generally do not partake of their news for a variety of reasons. Boo, Atlanta. But October 23rd, yesterday. 720-716-7300, the code 564-943-#. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Again, parents, no spectating. If other folks are just spectating, hanging out, then maybe we can wrap up early and do other things with our Saturday evening. I can get ready for our Global Sunday talk on racism. Did other folks have any comments that they wanted to make sure they got in? Let's see. Caller, I guess you're on the Skype line, as it were. Did you have comments here?
No commentary.
Other folks who dialed in with the hand, or I guess other folks, if you have commentary, folks are, again, just spectating. I hope they're not parents, attempted parents listening in who do not have answers to the question, because that would be I think, appreciated to have actual attempted parents to be able to respond to some of those questions, especially have children who are around that age range, 12, 11 or so.
Yes, can I be heard again?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir.
Yes, I think it's well, as I mentioned before, the parent did get a very, very good question from the child, but additionally to it, as I hear Mr. Fuller say sometimes, that sometimes you don't have to talk about directly about racism. You can talk, you can explain and audiovisual things on justice. And it is very educational, especially with a young person, to illustrate that, to show it in the form of illustration. You know, you may want to check around the inside, the interior of your house on what you have as presentations, as far as pictures that will reinforce constructive appearances, looks, defining what is acceptable, that some people call beauty, but I don't know about using that word, but that something that is acceptable can be heavily melanated, as Dr. Welsing states, with hair in its natural phase, that sort of thing. There's a lot of things that you can do to basically wage against racism, white supremacy by making the attempts at justice with your offspring in that light. Books, there are plenty of movies, documentaries or television programs. And what I've learned to do, and I have to kind of like hold my hand over my mouth, is a lot of times, because I talk too much, you know, on the subject, and just let the documentary do its work. And then the child probably would ask questions. If a child is going to ask questions about some sort of Disney World cartoon or whatever that movie, I guess, that we was talking about, then the child would also ask questions about the opposite form of things that you happen to present to them. And then that would be your opportunity to explain things. And from there, it will provide a constructive competing force against the propaganda version, the propaganda level of racism, white supremacy, I think. Traveling places with the idea in mind, with the plan, that would motivate that young person. Also incorporating maybe other people, other non-white people of like minds that have children also. It can be, you know, with daughters or mixed daughters and sons of children and around that age. All of the different ideas that you can incorporate to be able to offset that actual honest response from a child. A child in a sense doesn't know any better as far as how to be persuasive or sinister in most cases. And they're going to be very honest about what they say and how they describe things. So that's a good thing. And and as I mentioned before, the question that she asked was a great start. And hopefully I said some things that make sense. Thank you.
I'll just add to retired firefighter in Florida what he said about if it's going to be a movie type situation, since that was one of the suggestions, to not like talk and talk and talk and talk and talk, like if you all are going to watch it together, to just allow the film to do the work. Because I think a lot of us, I've been in this position myself where we get excited, especially if it's a film that we've seen before. Like, oh, did you see that? Oh, and really, like, that totally was like, just sit back. And then when it's done, they will maybe want to ask a question or five, or they might want to report. They might be really anxious, really excited to share, you know, what they saw. Allow them, you know, to be as excited as possible. And just, as he said, you might have to literally, no metaphor, you might have to literally take your hand and boop, cover that mouth. And just let them whirl. Let them talk. If they have questions or comments, and then if they have a question or two, there you go. Then you can answer their question or what have you. And try to ask them a few questions. Have in mind like a few things so you can really give them more of an opportunity to speak. Because, man, a lot of times they can answer their own questions and you'll be surprised. Like, you'll have to listen to some of the programs. Like, if you hear, we had preteens. We had 10-year, Justice was a co-host here at 10. So, I mean, you would be amazed. Brain computer of a 10-year-old can accurately process a lot of information. If you give it to them on terms they can understand that are age appropriate. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Let's see.
Other 15 folks. Seconds, Gus. Can I say something in 15 seconds?
I reckon.
In the DCS program, we have children from ages from 7 to 17. The ones who ask the most questions, it's not even close. It's the young ones from 7 to 10 years old. They are constantly asking questions, constantly, where the older children are the ones who are less open to ask questions. That's consistent with that program. Thank you.
That I can reference CASED one more time. Second worst book ever. And just striving for accuracy. Thomas in New York, Attempted Parent. Apparently, we are in agreement. I've said about five times now. Second worst book ever. Nutricide is the worst book ever. So apparently, I also think that CASED is worse. Then The Hate U Give, which was formerly worst book ever. But yes, second worst, like it's only one book worse than CASED, and that is Nutricide that we have been either feast, what they call it, feast or famine on the Cal's Book Club. Like it's been really, really good. A Terrible Thing to Waste, White Dog, or really, really bad. Nutricide, CASED, like whoo, hopefully we can get back to the good stuff after this is done. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. I think Rob in San Diego. Your volume is a little low. If you could speak up, that would be helpful.
Oh, is that better? Is that better?
Oh, okay. Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I was going to keep it really short, but just to answer the question as far as, like, what can one do to help the young child, preteen, learn about racism, I would suggest that sports at a ball game, if the child is into that male or female, may be a good way to point out certain things, especially when it comes to like coaching and ownership. And that's pretty much all I have. Thank you.
Anything that they are interested in, like that's what I said. Hey, is that true? Is everything about race, and we'll just evaluate. We could spend years until you come to, you know, a conclusion. Is that true? The reason I mentioned CASED, by the way, was just this week we mentioned it 2 days in a row now. She said that white people, if they were going to make a decision about hiring a black teacher, they would deliberately, standard operating procedure, hire the less qualified black educator. The racist reasoning: we do not want curious, eager black students, young black scholars, inquisitive, lots of questions. Oh, no. That's not what we want. So we deliberately hire less qualified, less competent black teachers so that we can impact generations of black students, make sure they're less ambitious. That's, now again, white people are ignorant about racism, white supremacy. It's still the second worst book ever, but there are a few bits of constructive information. Other folks with commentary to share. Line should be open. Oh, and I see the report is trending. Yes, sir, our caller in Florida. I was just saying the report is trending that I read yesterday from the L.A. Times about Munir McLean, M-U-N-I-R, young black male at O.J. Simpson's alma mater, where he filed for unemployment benefits, and now he has federal agents. He's under suspicion for, like, racketeering. He got suspended from the team, all of this for just trying to get unemployment benefits. And as a student athlete, they weren't playing. The season was canceled, so he was not employed. But, yes, that is trending. We did talk about this on Workplace Racism. Caller in Florida, yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. I wanted to start out with, as far as the reports for our county, we just had 191 new cases added for Friday, and I know we didn't have a game either today or last weekend, but there's still an issue with the students going to the bars and having these large gatherings. They just had like two or three fraternities, sororities under suspension for having these parties. So the white pretty much validates, well, not validation, but arrogance and entitlement still at a high rate. There was an employee, I think a high ranking person, a director at the local library, was demoted, and now she's suing the library, I guess, for something she posted on social media about Black Lives Matter. I'm thinking it was a white person, since they won't show the person's image on the local reports. As far as the victim of racism being questioned by the person conducting that interview about training, I guess, what, diversity training and race relations or whatever, I do agree they are the experts, white people are. I think they get a lot of entertainment out of that because they know that the black person, non-white person, doesn't know as much as they do. I thank you and the people on the line. And as far as like a lot of the books that I read, definitely helped me to gain a better understanding of the system and to help me come up with concepts, because it's going to take a lot of thinking, a lot of reading, and self-improvement to get to a solution about this issue, this problem. And as far as that debate from the other day between the candidates, I just can't, even with like the so-called rules they put in place, the, some people like to use the term gas, the comments they make, that kind of conduct, I can't see a black person being supported as a presidential candidate. you know, saying like, oh, well, oh, shut up, man. I think that's what Biden said one time. And, you know, the president saying stand back, stand by. A lot of those things, you know, they both are still white men, and they benefit heavily in a system of white supremacy. In fact, here locally, they're having an issue with a lot of the voters. It seems like a lot of black people being sent these text messages about the Proud Boys. Now, and then a day or two later, they're talking about Iran and Russia meddling or something like that with the election. And it's just a lot of confusion being put out on display. My last one would be the villages, right? Not too far away from me. Down in Ocala, they had the report. I seen a whole bunch of literal, like, red hats, MAGA, right? White people everywhere. Like, I don't even think, I think that, well, they had a black reporter go down there, and she was giving the updates, and then I noticed that they switched her out and then put a white person on there the next day coming up to the weekend. So they said the villages is like the largest retirement community or whatever, but everybody was white and they were very enthusiastic in their support for the president. So mass dedication, system of white supremacy. And that's all I have to say. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Reading is more important than watching television. Much obliged, caller in Florida. Florida, what they say, that's a key battleground state, you know, for the electoral college. Think Governor DeSantis will deliver for the president, his pal. I could be in error, but I think he did win Florida in 2016, so we shall see. I'm not surprised he gave the report about the Proud Boys. So this is from Forbes. Threatening email purported to be from Proud Boys tells Florida Democrats to vote Trump or else. It says some registered Democrats in Florida received a threatening email Tuesday with the subject line, vote for Trump or else, from an email that appears to be associated with a violent, there's that word, right-wing Proud Boys group in what local officials believe is an attempt at voter intimidation that the FBI is now investigating. The email told voters to cast their ballot for President Trump or we will come after you, telling voters that, wait a minute, you will vote for Trump on election day or we will come after you, the email read, change your party affiliation to Republican to let us know you received our message and will comply. We will know which candidate you voted for. I would take this seriously if I were you. The Proud Boys Seattle chapter, are you serious, which is officially affiliated with the group, denied that the Proud Boys were behind the emails, calling them a false flag operation and a LARP being carried out by someone who is soon to be exposed. They said a LARP. Come on. It's not clear how many Floridians received the emails Tuesday, but they seem to be solely sent to registered Democrats, voters in at least two of the state's largest counties. Brevard and Alachua received the emails, according to local media reports. Florida, with 29 electoral votes, could be a pivotal state in the presidential election. Polls show Trump and Democrat Joe Biden are neck and neck in the state, which, as Gus T. just said, Trump won by just over one percentage point in 2016. Any thoughts just based on your observations, our caller in Florida's? If you had to take a gander about which way your state will go, Biden or Trump?
It looks like it's leaning toward the president, because the reason I'm saying that is that, I don't know, there's something about that that unwavering dedication from just that event. Now, it might be, I don't know if it may be out of context, but it was a large amount of what they call white seniors. And that definitely could be a representation of the bulk of the state, especially when you go down to the southern part of Florida, where I know retired firefighters area. He mentioned about how the Spanish-speaking people tend to vote Republican as well. So I'm thinking that combined together, I can't wait to see what those numbers are going to be.
I did see some reports about so-called Latinos. You just could be Spanish-speaking white people, but I did see reports where some of those folks were saying they were going to still be with our president. We heard about the wall and all that, and he's made some regrettable comments, but we are with our president. 4 more years. Cuatro más. Cuatro más. I did hear that, so... Yeah.
Have you heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Yeah. At the rally the president did in Florida this week, there was a bunch of seniors at this rally, and he started saying, "I love my seniors." Said, "I saw the guy in the golf course, in the golf cart, and that's the guy who, the white pal in the golf cart." He shouted that guy out. At the debate, when asked about separating the immigrants from children from their mothers, he got ridiculed for, finished it off with, "The cages were clean. The cages were clean." Just typical white supremacy. This story came out a couple of days ago, and I've been looking at this app called TikTok because I realized my kids were on it. My children were on this app, so I started investigating. Then it became national news as Trump wanted to take it away from China and da-da-da-da. So feds are investigating racist, hate-filled TikTok threats into Georgia middle school students. And this is in Roswell, Georgia. U.S. Department of Homeland Security is investigating hate-filled death threats that were sent to black students at a Fulton County middle school via TikTok. The students at Elkins Point Middle School in Roswell got messages saying they would be lynched, skinned, and burned. All the students that were targeted were members of the Roswell High School Junior, the Roswell High Junior Hornets football team. These kids are 12 years old. And they spoke to a few of the parents, and these TikTok messages were directed specifically at these black students by their names. So just very interesting. Of course, the feds are investigating, and we'll see what happens. But this technology, this is the new way of practicing racism and getting away with it, and obviously this had to be someone who had knowledge of these children's names, probably another student, something to that effect, but they'll probably not find who did it. And I'll mute my line. Thank you, Gus.
So we started this program with a parent requesting information, counter-racist information, helping their preteen 12-year-old understand white supremacy. And so these folks... Middle school, 12 years old, accused of sending text messages to lynch, skin, and burn alive black 12-year-olds. Now, I don't have children. This might be the type of report I would share if I had a 12-year-old. Matter of fact, I know I would. If I had a 12-year-old, I would share this with them because they said, let me read a little bit. It says, this is from WSB-TV2. Feds investigating racist, hate-filled TikTok threats sent to Georgia middle school students. I'm skipping down a little bit. Channel 2's Mike Pechenik spoke to the father of a 12-year-old victim who said his son is terrified to go back to face-to-face learning at school. Retired firefighter said by the time that they get about 16, 17... they're not interested in asking any questions. You get enough years of this, your motivation and enthusiasm about school and learning, extinguished. Continuing. The children terrified to go back to face-to-face learning at school. Channel 2 Action News is not identifying the father to protect the identity of his son, but he says he wants someone to be criminally charged. I feel like everyone should get to the bottom of this and find out what happened, he said. Who started all this? The father said the messages called his son and his friends a racial slur. I'd like to know what it was exactly. If it was my son that did something bad, he would get in trouble, the father said. So I feel if someone does something wrong, legally, they should be held responsible. And it goes on from there. But I would share this report if I had a 12-year-old. So why does everything have to be about race? Is that true? We can think about the why. And then what should be done? Should we not, if it is true that everything is about race, racism, white supremacy, what should be done? Should we ignore incidents like this? Should we talk about incidents like this? Should we try to solve this problem? Should we talk about this a lot? If this is racism, this is about everything. But yeah, I would share this. Even wouldn't care if they got upset. Because, I mean, it is upsetting. It should be upsetting. But, I mean, you could have been that 12-year-old. If you have siblings, your brother, your sister could have been that 12-year-old. This happens every day, all over the world. Any other comments folks want to get in? We'll be here for the Global Sunday Talk on racism tomorrow, 3 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Central, 12 noon Pacific. Any other thoughts? Parents? Any other parents want to comment? Election thoughts they want to get in before we conclude?
Just some election history in the Miami-Dade County area, especially. White people who speak Spanish. That version of white people primarily comes from the island of Cuba. Since 1961, they have abandoned the quote-unquote Democratic Party when the Kennedy administration backed away from supporting white Cuban fashion in the Bay of Pigs invasion of Cuba. And they have been voting Republican ever since, you know. And, of course, as most of us know, that they are white people first, regardless of whatever the language it is. White people speak all types of languages. Including a lot of African languages they speak. But the bottom line is they are white people. I don't use the word Latino. I don't even know what the hell that means. That's some history just for anybody who doesn't know to know about. And that version of white people are followed by the smaller numbers of white people who speak Spanish from Venezuela, who've been recently coming into South Florida and a few other places, but the white people from Cuba dominate South Florida. Thank you.
System of racism, white supremacy. Much obliged, retired firefighter. I will ask some of our participants across the water tomorrow if, because I think some of them are parents, to see if they have any suggestions, tips for folks who are trying to do their best with offspring. I think patience is an enormous one. Wait a minute. One more email. I had a strange encounter with a white supremacist today. As I was tending to my vehicle to put my bags away, a white man runs out of his car and walks past me and yells to another white man, "How do you like those coyotes?" I am unsure if he even knew the other white man because I didn't hear a greeting, and also, this white man was sitting in his car for a while, I guess looking for a perfect time to practice racism without repercussions. Now, I doubt they were talking about the animal, and I believe they were talking in code, as coyotes also stand for the people that are paid to smuggle people across the border. I do think it's important, because I think we've had other listeners who have talked about strange encounters where it seems like white people may be talking in code, or at minimum, they're saying odd things. I think the caller in Florida said that happened at work. The fellow came through and made some sort of odd comment. And I said before, when you a white person and all of a sudden you found yourself in the middle of some sort of riddle, like, oh yeah, it's probably white supremacy racism. I don't know what coyotes means, but I think that is important. He talked about coyotes, the folks who do the smuggling, the southern border generally is what they're talking about, not from Canada. And they'll have codes, but that's in Joe Feagin's book, Two-Faced Racism, where he talks about they'll have, instead of saying niggers, they'll say Monday. So they can say, oh, I hate these Mondays. Oh, Mondays are just the worst. Oh, that type of thing is niggers. That's what they say. So it's lots of that. In fact, he has a whole chapter in that book where he says they, in the restaurant industry, they have a specific, very refined code where they can do all of that and talk about black people coming in to order food and black workers and all the rest of it. So, yeah, always trust your instinct. That's The Gift of Fear, Gavin DeBecker. That was one of the good ones, but we read that before this year, where he talked about, hey, if you get that sense that something is off here, I don't know if they're talking about me, but this seems peculiar, trust that instinct. They were probably practicing racism. White people have lots of code words for non-white people, victims of white supremacy. That's it. We'll be here tomorrow. Global Sunday Talk. Much obliged to all the folks who tuned in live. Hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. I think it was said already, we are going to need a lot of high-level thinking to solve this problem. Absolutely. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled again. I was, man, the fella that just wrote in here, I didn't know what he was going to say. I'm glad it wasn't anything violent. They just said, man, what about these coyotes? That could even be code, too. You get your rifle or whatever. It's a lot. You really have to be mindful. Why, he said the white man came running out of the house. Got to be alert. That's the type of thing that I said, you never know. He could have a firearm. This fellow's been sitting outside. He very well could have been waiting for an opportunity to practice racism. And it's just been so much chaos all throughout this year. The middle school white children are sending TikTok messages. We are going to lynch, skin, and burn you alive. You are not going to see 13. That's what I mean about hunker down. Like, man, I'm good on all this. If you got to go outside, it's something serious, essential, as they say. Head is on a swivel. You are super paying attention to everything. If it looks like somebody is getting loud, hostile, you should be thinking this female could have a firearm, or friends who are close by who have firearms. I'm getting out of here. I'm not getting into any sort of verbal confrontation. If this is not escalating at all, I'm exiting immediately. We'll have to try this again at a later, safe date. No unnecessary risks in 2020. That is, we are sober. If we got to go out, we're buckled and attentive. If you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Again, we need all of our attention. Be aware of our surroundings. And we are trying to do the small things to stay as safe as possible under conditions of white terrorism. Buckled, sober, not on the cell phone. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice as soon as possible. No name calling. Not even Ice Cube. No name calling. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. A victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.